Go ahead.
I don't know how to take
it. Go ahead.
So he wasn't talking about the radio.
Oh, I didn't know. Well, I could move over.
You'll be back. Okay. Good evening. This is the Thursday, March 2nd, 2017 meeting of the Harbor Advisory Board being held in the Vets Hall in Morro Bay. And I'm going to call the meeting to order. Mr. LaFay and Mr. McClish will not be with us this evening. Mr. Maloney is getting some papers, and he'll be back very shortly. We do have a quorum in the interim. So let's begin, please, with a moment of silence. Thank you. And let's do the Pledge of Allegiance. And Jeremiah, if you would mind leading us.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. So that brings us to advisory board and council liaison announcements and presentations. Councilman Makowetsky, do you have anything to share with us this evening? Okay, thank you. And we'll start, Gene, announcements?
Nothing right now.
Okay. Jeremiah?
No, nothing at the moment.
Lynn?
Yes, I'd like to announce that this weekend at the Morro Bay Yacht Club there will be the Mustang Regatta, which is the Cal Poly sailboat regatta. They started it, I think, 3 or 4 years ago. They get a pretty good turnout from up and down the state, boats coming from San Francisco down to San Diego. I don't know exactly what the registration has been thus far, but we're hoping for good weather and some exciting sailing. You can see them out on the bay. They'll be mostly toward the south. What did you tell me? In front of the fuel dock in the open area down there.
And Lynn, what kind of boats are they, please?
Oh, the college kids sail an FJ. It's a flying junior, 14-foot boat, 2 crew on each boat.
Okay, thank you. And we'll ask Neil when he gets here, but I have a couple of announcements. The 28th annual Dixon Spaghetti Dinner fundraiser is set for March 17th at the Morro Bay Community Center from 5 to 7:30 p.m. Dinner admission is $12 for adults, $7 for kids and under. The dinner admission fee includes spaghetti, salad, garlic bread, dessert, and non-alcoholic drinks. And this year, there will be wine and beer available for purchase at the event. The Morro Bay High School Bluegrass Ensemble will be providing music. The dinner is an important fundraising event that benefits the Community Foundation of Estero Bay's Youth Scholarship Program. Think in terms of financial scholarships. The scholarships assist children from lower-income families to participate in the City Recreation Division's Youth Sports and Enrichment Programs. Without that assistance, deserving children may not be able to participate in these great programs, programs that build health and character, all while the kids have fun doing so. During the dinner, 3 lots of raffles will be held, with each raffle lot loaded with good stuff. Raffle tickets will be sold at the door and inside the event. Also, tickets for a cake walk, which is a pretty fun thing to watch, actually, will be available, with cake walk winners receiving a delicious cake. The dinner is a joint endeavor of the Community Foundation of Estero Bay, the Morro Bay Senior Citizens Incorporated, the Morro Bay Recreation and Parks Commission, and the City of Morro Bay's Recreation Services. Another announcement: on March 31, April 1, and April 2, Our local organization, 501c3 Morro Bay Beautiful, will be sponsoring the 14th annual citywide yard sale, which may be the largest yard sale on the Central Coast. Sellers who register at the Morro Bay Chamber of Commerce by March 14th will be featured on the yard sale map, and the maps will be available prior to yard sale weekend and during that weekend at Brenda Sue's consignment store at 248 Morro Bay Boulevard in Morro Bay. Also, and this is something lots of folks don't know, during the week immediately following the yard sale, the Morro Bay Garbage Company will pick up 12 extra bags of trash for free, as well as any electronics or large items over 75 pounds or larger than 4 feet by 4 feet for only $10 each. You must call the garbage company at 805-528-7430 to schedule the pickup of large items. Finally, and as a general note, during discussion of agenda items during the Harbor Advisory Board meetings, I will attempt to remember to ask each of the board members in turn if they have comments or questions, with the chair going last. So we'll take it from one end back to the other each time. So you needn't worry about having to raise your hands or get anybody's attention. Neil, announcements?
None for me.
Okay. So that brings us to public comment for any item not on this meeting's agenda, or public comment for any member of the public not able to attend the meeting long enough for a particular agenda item to be addressed. Do we have any public comment? Lexi?
I liked your additional that anyone who doesn't stay for the length of the meeting. I have two items.
Could you identify yourself, please?
I'm Lexi Bell from the Morro Bay National Estuary Program. And I had two items that I wanted to speak to you briefly about. One is that every 3 years, the Morro Bay National Estuary Program puts on a State of the Bay series of events where we educate the public on how the bay is doing, how clean the water is, and how well the habitats and the birds and the fish are doing in the bay and in the watershed. And we put out a report, and we do a bunch of different events. And so that's coming up in April. And the first event is April 1st. We're having a talk about clean water at the upstairs room above the Libertine Pub. And the Libertine is also launching a wild ale that afternoon that will, some proceeds will go to the program. So that's something to put on your calendars if you want to hear about clean water and the bay, April 1st from 4 to 6 p.m. There's also a whole calendar of other events throughout the month that you can see on our website, which is, if you Google Morro Bay National Estuary Program, we come right up.
Any questions or comments from the board?
A real quick story. Years ago in the State of Bay conference, whatever, they had hired the Tigers Farley to come out and go up and down the bay there. And they pulled up to my barge when I was pulling a mooring, and they all wanted to come out and see what was going on and all the little stuff there. So we set up a lab right on the barge, and all these people started showing up and getting on the barge, but they're in high heels and shoes and clean, and they're really clean. And I'm going, you can't really be here, you know. So, but they learned a lot. So it was fun.
We'll have to add that to our agenda, our list of events next time.
Sounded like an offer to me.
The other item I wanted to speak briefly about is in regards to how eelgrass is doing in the bay. There's an item in the agenda about eelgrass updates and some discussion of a report that we've released about eelgrass in the bay, and I wanted to provide a little bit of background. The estuary program periodically conducts aerial flights over the bay that collect imagery that can be classified into different vegetation types, for example, eelgrass, and we can create a map of where we see eelgrass in the bay. And that's the kind of imagery that you see in that report and in those in the maps that you may have seen showing a decline in eelgrass since 2007 across the bay. That mapping effort only can capture eelgrass in what's called the intertidal, so areas of the bay that sometimes are exposed during low tide and then underwater during high tide. It doesn't capture any eelgrass that's below that in the subtidal areas, which I think is the kind of eelgrass you're encountering more in the north part of the bay around the docks. It's much deeper. It's areas that are not being exposed at low tide and therefore not not even captured in those maps. So I just wanted to clarify that, and clarify that although our flight that was flown in 2007 and 2010 were in September, October timeframe, and 2013 was in the spring. In theory, that would work for us because you would get the minimum amount showing up in the fall and the maximum amount showing up in the spring. So the fact that we saw very little in the spring is concerning because that would be the period of the growing season where you would see a lot of eelgrass. We are planning on doing another flight if we can procure enough funds to afford it this fall, so we'll have another map to share with the community about how eelgrass is doing in the intertidal. We're also working right now to map some of the subtidal, the eelgrass that is lower in the bay that we have never had the capability to map before. So I wanted to provide a little background on that since it came up in your agenda.
Lexi, how much time do you have this evening?
Probably about 45 minutes to an hour.
If we, if it works for you, and if you and the Eelgrass Committee think it would be useful for you to stay, once we get through our consent agenda, and with the board's agreement, we can move the eelgrass business item up to the front.
Sure, if that. I'm happy to do that.
Okay. All right. Okay. Well, thank you for hanging around.
Thank you. Yes,
good.
No problem.
Thanks. Okay, so that brings us to the consent agenda. And the only item we have on the consent agenda is A1, approval of minutes from the Harbor Advisory Board meeting held on February 2. And it says 2016, but it should be 2017. And so do I hear a motion? To approve?
I'll make that motion. That we approve the minutes from February 2nd, 2017.
I'll second that.
Okay. Any discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Carries. So that brings us to our business item agenda. And if the board is in agreement, we'll move agenda item C3. Up to the beginning of our business agenda. Do I see any objections to that?
No, it sounds good.
Everybody's good? Okay, so that is the update from the Eelgrass Ad Hoc Committee. And Neil?
Lynn.
Oh, sorry, thank you. Lynn, sorry, take it away.
Status report? Oh. Okay. We had a meeting of the Eelgrass Committee at which Neil brought a report from Mr. Bob Fowler, and at this point I'm going to let him discuss that report. It is in the packet for anybody who wants to read it in detail.
So Bob Fowler is a waterfront leaseholder who took over from Burgess Landing and is the most recent, Gene can speak maybe to the recent level, but he just completed a construction project. So he had to do the pre-approval, the during construction he had to observe, and he's got another study that's going to be coming up in about a year. It's 2 years after completion. You have to follow back and do another study. So the letter that he wrote that I attached to the front, and Bob is aware that all this was getting entered in today. I just wanted to kind of do a higher-level overview of this and not get into the details of this, but we put this into the entire report so that people at home or here on the board could at their leisure read more of the details of what it actually means to develop a property on the waterfront and what it looks like and what it actually costs you to go through this process. And I spoke with Lexi today to have her come in because they're very involved in the eelgrass as well, in a different role than, you know, development. They're more of a observing and helping with mitigation and doing research. And so I'm not going to go through and just read all of this, but there was some interesting facts that came out of this report from Tenera, which was one of the companies, or which is, as far as I know, one of the only companies that's really geared to do this work and to do the scientific research, which then would allow the work to be approved or denied. So Bob, in this notes, that he highlighted a paragraph, and I understand when it gets copied that you can't tell what was highlighted. So I'm just going to read this single paragraph out of the report from Tenera, and this is under the discussion heading. It says, an important additional finding from the project survey in eelgrass being found to be significantly more abundant than 10 years ago in the same area, figure 8, different mapping methods were used across surveys. Both the results indicate eelgrass underwent an approximate 250% increase in abundance between 2006 and 2016. In comparing the same areas between years, the increase in the dock area relative to the same control area surveyed in 2006 and 2016 represents well over a 600% increase over the past 10 years. Eelgrass increased more in the dock area than in the control areas on a relative basis. So I also want to give a disclaimer that this is not to be representative of the entire bay. You know, as Lexi reported on that this, you know, the bay in general since 2007 has had declining eelgrass, but like any other organism in nature, my personal anecdote is that things die, other things grow, stuff moves around, and just because it wasn't there in one year doesn't mean it can't move. That's not me drawing any conclusion, but just maybe giving a little support to that. But other than that, I just wanted to make sure this report was included for everybody's education.
Thank you. Jean, did you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, Bob's eelgrass mitigation was under the original eelgrass mitigation policy. Since then, we are now underneath the Southern California eelgrass mitigation policy, which at this point allows no mitigation or no loss of any eelgrass. So you can't mitigate any eelgrass. You can't transport any eelgrass to a new location. And currently, that was an example of what you could have done. Now you cannot do anything. And we're in the process of creating our own eelgrass mitigation policy. And I'll leave it back to Lynn.
Thank you. We have been looking at this issue. The city wants to create an eelgrass policy. There is one already done down in the harbor of Newport Beach. They have their own eelgrass protection and mitigation plan, which is only for Newport, so they are in certain ways like us, although I'm sure their conditions in some ways are different. But the city, the Newport Harbor, is taking the lead responsibility in eelgrass mitigation and reporting and surveying, and they have developed their own methods of doing that. And that is also available. It's from the Harbor Department of Newport Beach. But looking at Morro Bay, we know that eelgrass is critical to the bay, to the estuary, and keeping it healthy and alive. We know that eelgrass abundant, that it is declining. The estuary program has put out multiple reports on that, and I don't think there's any argument there. And we know that it needs to be protected and in some way mitigated and fostered. Permitting, as seen in Mr. Fowler's report, permitting is very difficult. You do an initial assay in order to get a permit. You do a pre-construction assay of eelgrass. You do a plan for mitigation, and you do a post-construction assay of eelgrass to see what has happened to it during your construction. And then, is it every year or every 2 years, they do another follow-up study of eelgrass. And this, as apparent, it's very costly to the developer. It slows down any progress, and now if they can't mitigate at all, then there is no improvement nor even, in many cases, maintenance of the infrastructure that is in tidal lands. I don't think that, in general, is good for our harbor. It's not good for our city. This city is very dependent on the estuary. So taking these things into consideration, it is the opinion of the committee that we really ought to vigorously encourage the city to continue and to develop a formal eelgrass policy perhaps much like the one that they have done in Newport Beach. We believe that this would help in the future with those who need permits that would go beyond the requirements of the city to Coastal Commission or other regulatory agencies, that assessments could be standardized, perhaps even all carried out by the same government entity, perhaps the NEP and Cal Poly University would undertake that and be involved in these studies, that doing it that way, we could better protect the bay and the eelgrass. We could perhaps reduce the costs of the surveys that developers are having to undertake, and the eelgrass in general would be better protected. So, any comments?
Then we're also thinking about expanding our ad hoc committee to bring in some expertise to help us along those lines.
Absolutely.
Yes.
We would certainly need a lot of help, especially when it comes to something that's a formal study that is beyond just a study of this nature. NEP has been very instrumental in all of this work. They know a lot about it. We would certainly hope that they would help us out. We would also look to the Marine Sciences Division of Cal Poly, as well as perhaps the consultants who have done other work, like Tenera or is it Anchor, who have helped the
Anchor QEA.
Anchor QEA would all be involved. And part of this would also involve hopefully finding other ways of mitigation, things that we can do that would be allowed under the CEMP, California Eelgrass Mitigation Policy, methods of mitigation that are not available because there is no standard, there are no institutions to take over this, and that perhaps with between the city, Cal Poly, NEP and these other entities that we would be able to expand mitigating ways of mitigation.
Did we find out if that plan was approved by the Coastal Commission?
No, I don't know exactly. I think, Eric, you said something that the mitigation policy for Newport was approved by the Coastal Commission, but when I read the copy of it online today. I did not see any indication of that.
I believe it was accepted by the regulators. It was a 5 or 7 year effort, but I mean, I can follow up with that.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure if it isn't approved, it's darn close. I know they've been working. It isn't just something they created and handed to the regulators and said, here, approve this. They worked hand in hand with the regulators to make sure it was something that would fly with them. So it's
right. I found one draft from 2013, and that said draft, but then on October 14th of 2015, there was, it no longer said draft, it was the actual policy, so, but that wasn't all that long ago, so perhaps you could find that out for us at some time.
So as an ad hoc committee, we were kind of hoping to get input, I think, from the board about our ideas about bringing on somebody from Cal Poly, the NEP, and possible consultants, Kathy Novak, we talked about, since she's worked with a lot of these projects, and just making sure that we were going down the right path as the city wanted to change our course from education, which we started as, moving into considering policy.
Well, it's a key issue. It touches more than one of the current goals for the city, the principal one being economic development. So I don't see any reason, unless council advises us to the contrary, and Councilman Makowetsky can tell us later on, I don't see any reason why the committee can't change, or I should say alter its direction, update its direction is a better way to put it. And as far as adding members are concerned, that's the discretion of the committee.
Yeah, I was just curious that would the committee itself be creating policy or a proposal for the policy?
You would recommend as a council.
Right, but it would be crafted and we would...
We'd bring it back here.
It would come, I think...
We would give the package to the council.
No, the committee works for the board, and the board works for the council. So the committee, if the board agrees, which is Neil's point, if the board agrees that the committee can move in the direction of exploring and potentially developing an appropriate policy, then they would bring that to the board. The board would hear it and deliberate and might or might not recommend to the city council that the council consider adopting such a policy. I have a couple of quick questions on this. And is the committee done?
Yes.
Okay, great. That's it. Lexi, before I have my questions, do you have anything you'd like to add? You are more than welcome. You are the fount of knowledge.
So. Oh, thank you. Well, I think it's collective in our organization. We did have a NEP employee come and speak with the committee and give some input on our current technical knowledge of eelgrass. And I think depending on the meeting timing, we'd be happy to have somebody participate in the future if that if that's what you decide to do. And we are currently coordinating with Cal Poly on a number of research and pilot restoration efforts in the Bay. So we already are created quite a good working relationship with some researchers at Cal Poly on eelgrass. So that's something we can certainly, I think, take advantage of in the future.
So you think that synergy is feasible?
I think the synergy of us working together with Cal Poly to provide expertise to the committee is feasible. Whether you'll need more than that as you get into a more technical mitigation plan, that is very likely if it's going to be something where you're writing a whole document that needs some time. But
okay, thank you. Yeah. Okay, and I have a couple of quick questions on this before we move on. So the current policy that Gene, I think you referred to it as state policy. Is it legislated?
I think it's through NOAA. So I think it's federally.
Oh, so.
Eric?
The California Eelgrass Mitigation Policy, it's National Marine Fisheries Service. So it's federal fish and wildlife. I do not believe it's legislature. It's not law. It's policy guidance, but it essentially becomes law when coastal and other regulators look at it to put conditions on projects, and they look at the policy and say, okay, I want, you know, policy 2A, it's going to be your condition, your permit. It essentially kind of has the power of law in that it becomes a permitting process.
And if you and or the committee know what regulatory entity is Newport dealing with?
It's the same ones. Coastal Corps of Engineers, National Marine Fisheries, State Fish and Wildlife.
At this point, it's kind of a circle of pointing fingers. So no one's willing to step up and say, let's, you know, move ahead.
So. Well, when Eric got up to five different agencies, I my mind automatically went in a circle. So, yeah. Okay, anything else on this agenda item?
At some point, we may have to hire a consultant to help us through this process, and that'll come back through us to you guys.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Lexi, thank you. Thanks for hanging.
And if I may, Lexi, we will absolutely plan our meetings when you are also available to help us out, because we do value your input very much from the NEP. Thank you.
Okay, that brings us to back to item B, which is the Harbor Department status report. Eric, thank you for your patience.
No problem. Thank you. A few things to cover here. Trying to be brief. Harbor Patrol statistics for the month of February: 5 emergency responses, 101 calls for service, 21 assists, 27 assists, and 23 enforcement contacts, and 18 weathered hazards. That's probably hazardous bar warnings. or gale warnings. He might have even had a storm warning in there, one of those weather systems we had come through. All in all, it's been busy. Hasn't been out of control busy. A lot of loose gear and material floating around, and a lot of stuff coming down the watershed, but no real mayhem, knock on wood. So far, so good, and people have been good about taking care of their boats and making sure they're tied up. We've only had one mooring. One boat broke loose, but that wasn't because of a bad tie-up job. The chain broke. Yeah, it was one of the Marina Square moorings, something. Was it the swivel? The usual suspect. Yeah, so, but it ended well. We were able to grab it before it.
That particular mooring, the swivel, the mooring was due for inspection in 1 week.
So it fell short by 7 days. But Harbor Patrol was able to grab that before it headed down the bay further. Fortunately, it just headed up through the mooring or through the anchorage area, so it didn't cause any damage, which was good. February 9th, the patrol responded to 4 double kayaks and able to turn back to Kayak Horizons. Strong outgoing tidal flow. They were caught north of the rental place there, so we had to end up bringing them back and cart their kayaks back as well. All were unharmed, fortunately. And on February 17th, one of the heaviest rain days we had some wind to 79 knot. That's the sailboat I said from Marina Square that went drifting. Had a fair couple of sails break loose. Lynn, I know you were there trying to batten down your hatches. And
calling you on two others that lost their
sails? Yeah, we were chasing some sails and chasing some skiffs down, but all in all, I think the wind had a fair amount of east in it, so it wasn't blowing up the bay. It didn't have a lot of fetch, so we didn't have a lot of chop. It was just high wind, which made a huge difference. So that went by, and we'll see what the rest of the weather, rest of the winter brings. On the dredging front, you may have noticed there's a dredge out. They've been moving a good amount of yardage. They've got about 250,000 cubic yards to move. They've moved about, I'm going to say close to probably 75, maybe 80,000. The majority of the material is out in the sand trap and out by the Navy Channel. You'll notice the pipeline came off the beach day before yesterday. That's because of snowy plover nesting season. The pipeline, they were down off the Innitmore Bay, running the pipeline under the channel all the way out and then up the beach. Worked pretty well, but it's a pretty small dredge, so it didn't have a lot of volume moving, so they've had slow going because they're pushing that material so far. But they're doing okay. They're getting there. I think they're still down at the Innitmore Bay for another day. I think they've maybe got back up operating today. They're going to run the pipeline now out through the ocean. It goes out to the near shore disposal area off the sand spit is where they'll dispose now. So they're going to finish off at the Innitmore Bay and then move to Tidelands. They've got about 15 or 20,000 cubic yards to finish off Tidelands. They're moving about 400 cubic yards a day, so you can do the math and figure out how long it'll take. And then they'll move back to the Navy Channel, which is off of our North T Pier, and then to the sand trap, which is in between the South Jetty and the Inner Grun Jetty. They're scheduled to be done about May, somewhere between the 20th and the 26th. I mean March 20th to 26th, and then the Aquina is coming shortly on the heels right after that in May 1st, so we'll see the Aquina coming to clean up our harbor engine. So once all this equipment's gone, we should have our channels in good shape and get all those high spots off, especially near Tidelands Dock. We know the dredge has been operating 24/7. It's a small operation. It's not the big operators that we typically get because it was a small one-off contract that small business set-aside contracts, so we got a small contractor, which means they take longer and they have smaller equipment. They're operating, they've shielded their engines as best they can. They're trying to operate. The sound coming off it is somewhat directional, and they're trying to position themselves at night so that they send most of the direction out to sea. But we're still asking the community's patience as we dredge and keep the Corps of Engineers and their contractor here. $7 million job. We can't afford to do it ourselves, so we just hope everybody has patience while the Corps comes and goes, and then we get them out of here and get our harbor good and up and operational again. When the wet weather set them back a little bit, mostly the wind. The rain didn't really slow them down, mostly the wind. They haven't had a couple little boo-boos in the beginning in terms of pipe popping up and boats running into it, but nothing major. Everyone, plastic pipe, so it doesn't do a lot of damage, and everyone's going slow. So do mind the yellow buoys. If you see a yellow buoy, that generally means there's an anchor on top of the pipeline right there, so it's safe to pass near yellow buoy. It's not an exclusion zone. It just marks where the pipeline is. So if you're navigating down the channel, you're best safe. Just if you've got room, just stay away from the yellow buoys in case the pipeline pops up. But after the first couple of days operation, once they get it going and they get plenty of sand in the pipe, it weighs down to the bottom. It doesn't go anywhere. So, Lynn, you had a question?
When you're finished.
I'm finished.
How long will a pipe be floating on top of the water? It came up probably about 3:30 this afternoon. I had already rowed across, so I did not have to row around it, which I hope it's not going to be in the middle of the channel when I row home.
They had a couple of buoys. I know there's one, a yellow buoy, somewhere off Yacht Club-ish, Marina Square area. When they popped it up on, I think it was Tuesday. Yeah, they popped it up Tuesday, the whole length of it. There's a couple spots where those yellow buoys were was anchored, so it went back down to the bottom. So there were a couple spots you can pass. So if, look for the yellow buoy. That's where you can pass if the pipeline's up. But it floats just right on the surface. With your skiff, you could probably get over it.
You can see it all the way from the Estero Inn down to Marina Square.
Mm-hmm.
Considerable distance.
Yeah.
For boats that couldn't see that, it would be, if it's going to be up all night.
It shouldn't be up all night. That's definitely not their aim. They keep it on the surface as short a period of time as possible.
Thank you.
Eric, could you ask them to put some more buoys to the north of the yacht club along Morro Bay Marina and further out? At this point, there is none, and I don't know where their pipeline is when I drop anchors.
Yeah, that's a good point, because you're doing all your mooring. When they popped it up, your barge was right on kind of the northeastern corner there. We were a little bit worried it was going to come up underneath, but it was off far. And the wind swung around. The wind blew. It was right at the tide change, so you were swinging wide. Okay, I'll see if they can get that better mark through there. But once they pull out of there, they're going to, I think, probably middle or so next week, depending on how production goes, they should be pulling out of there completely, then all that pipeline will be gone. They'll be back at the north end.
Eric, before you leave the dredging topic, I boated down through where I think the dredging was taking place at the south end of the channel, and I noticed that it's very irregular in terms of hills and valleys. Is that to be expected?
The area that they dredged on the bottom?
Yeah.
How were you able to see it?
My depth sounder.
Ah. Your x-ray vision or something.
Well, no, I was actually a little startled.
They're not done down there. That's probably the only explanation I can use. They do, if you've seen them, they'll spud down. They'll put a piling down and kind of pivot back and forth and then move it. And, you know, I think they walk it and kind of do this. So you're going to tend to get somewhat of a crescent-shaped, hilly pattern as they go, but it should eventually smooth itself out. And once they get the volumes out and survey, which is what they get paid on, they get paid for how much they pull out, so including hills and valleys. So they should be getting everything down to an average design depth they're trying to. Any real high spots, they should be able to go back and get. But, yeah, if there's some ridges in there, that's fairly normal.
And that was my next question. Is there a contractual design depth?
Yes. Okay. I think it's 12 feet back there in that channel.
Thanks.
I think that's all I got for dredging. So, again, the equipment will be back early May, and then we're going back to Washington, D.C. on Sunday with CMANC. I didn't put that in here, but obviously that's pretty tied to dredging. We're good funded now. We're in good shape. Hopefully into the president's budget we'll get funding for the equipment for next year, but that's one of our primary missions next week is make sure that we've got our funding in place and meet our new legislators.
Yep.
Is it on what he's talking about
right
now?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, go ahead.
With with going to CMANC, are you going to have an opportunity there to talk to them about the mix of sediment that could possibly affect the State Park Marina?
Yes and no. When at my CMANC winter meeting down in Redondo Beach, we had the Corps of Engineers and US EPA there, and the subject of that rule was brought up. It's called the 80-20 rule, where you're supposed to have 80% or better equivalent grain material size to the beach that you're disposing on, which the State Park Marina doesn't have. when that rule was brought up, the Corps pointed to EPA, and the EPA pointed to Corps, and both of them kind of said, well, I thought that was your rule. It's not a legislated number that you have to hit. It's kind of like the eelgrass mitigation policy. It's guidance policy, but it becomes law when it gets enacted into permits. EPA and the Corps promised to look into that. Corps, I know, is doing it now, and we're in contact with our Corps folks, and we're going to be trying to identify the right persons or the right office in Washington, D.C. to bring that up with. Problem with the EPA is they're all on the West Coast next week. This time of the year, a lot of the different staffers, if you recall last year when we went to Washington, D.C., all the NOAA folks, National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration folks, were all on their annual road trips all over the country. So, you know, we kind of swapped coast with them. We're doing the same thing with EPA this year. Right now is when all their higher up administrative folks kind of disappear across the country doing their road trip. So unfortunately, we're going to miss the EPA, but we are going to bring that up with Corps. Is that it on dredging? Okay. Recent council activity. On the 14th, we brought the RFQ for the boatyard to the council for approval. They did vote to allow us to release that. They didn't really have any comments to change on it. Not that we expected they would. So we've putting that out. I've got it together. I've got the final draft ready to go. I had hoped to have gotten it on the road or gotten the ether tomorrow or yesterday, but got stuck behind having to go up to Monterey to help them out on an interview panel for the harbor master position up there. So I did not get that out yesterday, but I am determined to get that out tomorrow and get that RFQ out on the street. Also on the 14th, the council considered a conditional use permit for exception for Gray's Inn at 561 Embarcadero. They're proposing a modest remodel where they're also adding the harbor walk, boardwalk on the backside, some ADA conversion of some room and gallery space, and then vertical access from Embarcadero Street down to the harbor walk. In addition to doing some parking rearrangements and sign things, council gave an exception on one, but not an exception on the other, and wanted to bring it back at a later date. But larger project-wise, it didn't really have any bumps in the road. It was mainly over signage and parking and wanting some exceptions for that because, as you know, the parking there is sort of substandard. Four parking spaces or three parking spaces there just pulling off the highway or pulling off the roadway. So that is going to be continued on to another council meeting. Gene, you got anything to add to that? You're project architect on that. On the 28th, the council, at least when I wrote this, they were considering approval of amendment to the lease for Estero Landing. They approved it Tuesday night. It was a 10-year extension of the lease for substantial tenant improvements, including new docks, gangways, and some significant wharf work since about 2009 through 2016. Dock and gangway work had been done like 2009 through 2011, and wharf work more recently. So the council approved that. And council on the 28th considered materials for us to bring to Washington Week for the Washington, D.C. trip. Gave us a little bit of input on some of the leave-behind letters that we'll leave with our representatives. So that was good to give the council an update on that. As of this time, we don't have grant funding to get to D.C. We've typically gone and gotten cable committee, fishery cable liaison committee grants for that trip. The cable committee itself, from what I understand, has not set all their parameters for their granting, figured out how much they're going to have to spend and by what date deadlines and whatnot the grant process will work. So we've not been able to apply for a grant. My understanding is in early March the cable committee folks are getting together to have their meeting to set what the grant parameters are, and then they'll open up the grant program and we'll apply for it in arrears. The executive director, Chris Kubiak, has indicated that we can apply in arrears for it, but we're funding our trip now to go, and hopefully we'll get funding for that when we get back. And finally, on the 28th, last Tuesday, the Central Coast Aquarium, who's the group from Avila that is proposing to rebuild the Morro Bay Aquarium, take the existing site and basically level it and take the street in next door and build out a $20 million facility. They've got basically pre-approved for a grant or pre-approved for a loan from USDA to build a $20 million facility. They've got to do a feasibility study. They're raising the $40,000 to do that now. They're about halfway there. They don't see any problems with raising that funding. Once they get that funded, they'll do a feasibility study. They've already done their own internal, and I'm assuming they're not pursuing this because they don't think it's going to be able to make it financially. But that's one of the steps they need to secure that funding from the USDA. They're a little behind in their compliance deadlines that we gave them last year, actually 2015, when they first came on the scene with a proposal and the council said, okay, we want to work with you. We set some deadlines at the end of last year for them to have plans submitted. The big game changer was, and that was based on them doing fundraising on their own to get the funding in place to do it. The big game changer was middle of last year, USDA coming along and offering to loan them up to $20 million. So that changed the whole playing field, and they've really been pursuing that now. So we're giving them an extra year to get through all these performance deadlines. But we don't anticipate any problems with them reaching those. Beach lifeguard applications are now open for the 2017 season, as are junior lifeguard applications. You can find them on the city's website, morrobayca.gov. Just go look for job opportunities. They're due by March 16th up at City Hall. So if you want to be a lifeguard on the beach this summer or work on the junior lifeguard program, get your applications in. We will be doing a lifeguard academy as well to train our prospective lifeguards, as we do generally every year. Don't have exact dates for that yet, but look for those dates coming up here in the future. So get out and apply for those, and then be seeing the lifeguards come out come the beginning of summer. Past events, Women for Fishery enchilada sale. Past event on February 4th. Believe that was a good fundraiser they had there. Sold lots of enchiladas. I know I got a couple trays, so it's good stuff. If you missed that, don't miss it next time. And the Big Bad and Ugly Surf Invitational Contest was supposed to be February 18th and 19th, but they canceled it. Tim Cowan was the event coordinator for that, and 2 weeks out, he was a little worried about the surf and weather forecast, and a week out, he didn't get feeling any better, and so he ended up canceling about 10 days out. But fortunately, and unfortunately, the weather bore out. It was big, and it was stormy, and it would not have been a good time to hold a contest. Had it gone the other way and been a great day, of course, he would have been vilified and hung out to dry. But the weather bore out. Fortunately, forecasts now are pretty accurate, so he was able to get a good, accurate forecast 10 days out, and they canceled that. And I don't think they're planning on doing a redo. Is that the first time ever it's been canceled?
First time we've canceled. We've stopped a few contests, but That's the first time we ever stopped or canceled one ahead of time.
Yeah, well, it was a prudent move.
Oh, yeah, it was 20 foot.
And yeah.
60-mile-an-hour wind.
Yeah, it would not have been good.
Big, bad, and ugly.
Too bad.
Upcoming events. The Maritime Institute, the institute down in San Diego, is coming up here March 6th through the 17th, two-week period, and holding a captain's license course to get either six-pack or 50-ton, 100-ton type licensing to get that coursework to take the test. Then you got to get your sea time and apply for all the other things to get your captain's license, but that's open to the public if people want to come in and take advantage of that here in town. I know we did this with our Harbor Patrol about 10 years ago, well, even more than that, 15 years ago, because Maritime Institutes, it takes a fair amount of time to get enough interest up here to put together the class to make it worthwhile for them, and they've got enough interest now, so they've got it, and let's say the more the merrier. So if you want to attend that class, come down to our Harbor Department office and check in. It's coming up pretty quick. We've got a Rescue Watercraft Conference March 13th and the 14th over a weekend. That's K-38, which is the training outfit that we've been working with for the last 20 years. They had been holding conferences annually up until about 4 or 5 years ago and kind of faded out. Well, they're getting back in. It's international to have folks coming from all over the world coming to provide their experiences and get good training and good professional development. And Ron, I apologize, I missed your Dixon spaghetti feed. Didn't have that one on the list, but thanks for remembering that one. And last but not least, the spreadsheet on the bottom of the status report is the long-awaited status of pending HAB recommendations. So instead of you guys having to ask me every time, what's the status of this, what's the status of that, this is my spreadsheet. I'm trying to keep current on what the status of Harbor Advisory Board recommendations is with the City Council and with staff. So left column is the recommendation, the middle column is the date in which it was recommended, and the status is over on the right. First one is HAB recommending staff draft a letter to City Council encouraging the council pursue negotiating with state parks to assume both the cafe and marina concessions. As you know, we had state parks here and it's probably a year and a half or 2 years ago now, looking at a process to try and reconcession those two facilities. The input taken at the last one we had was mainly support for Don at the Bayside Cafe, though it was just the Parks' intention was just take input on what sort of facilities they wanted to see. Our last contact with staff, which we did go to staff, or we did go to State Parks shortly after that hearing, and including I think we went to the City Council after the Harbor Advisory Board, and the City Council wanted to pursue looking at the city taking over the Bayside concession as well. At that point, Parks had no interest in giving up the cafe concession. Since that time, like I said, it's been maybe 2 years now, all the Parks key personnel have turned over. The main concession person that we were working with up in Sacramento was retired. Dan Fallat with State Parks, he was a superintendent. He's moved on to the county. Dan Fallat's in the he's the new superintendent with the county. And who moved on? Who was it before, Matt? Who was our park superintendent before Dan Fallat? I'm drawing a blank. But anyhow, a lot of the key personnel have moved on. So we're really at kind of the start over point with Parks. And getting back in talks with them to see where they want to go with that State Park Marina concession and the idea of us taking over the thing completely. As you know, the operating agreement says that once we complete the renovation and dredging project as originally envisioned, which was a very comprehensive project that we couldn't find funding for, mainly because of the cost of dredging, the agreement said we could take over the marina operation after that or lease it back out to a concession. We obviously haven't finished dredging or renovating the marina, but the intent is still there, and so the idea being we take over that concession for both the cafe and the marina and see if then at that point financially it starts to pencil out a little bit better to get the whole thing done. So we'll be looking with to Parks here in the not-too-distant future to try and re-spark those talks and see where they want to go with that. Next one on the list is that recommendation of the staff provide council with modified sections of Morro Bay Municipal Code 15.24, which I believe is the harbor sanitation section, and develop environmental BMPs. We are incorporating BMP efforts into our ongoing rules and regulations update project, as you know, last year and good part of last year and probably back into even 2015. We took a lot of input on rules and regulations and updating them and modernizing them. I've been slowly picking away at those as time allows and eventually going to swing those back to the Harbor Advisory Board. I'm hoping to bring the first set through at the next meeting in April. I'm going to kind of take it in as a section by section again and bring back the input that you gave me as a Harbor Advisory Board and from my staff, and then we'll bring back a final version of certain sections for nod of approval here, and then we'll bring those on back to the council. So we'll be seeing those coming pretty soon. Any questions on that one? So you can ask questions one by one here. Nope. Next one is that council directs staff to engage. It's the Harbor Advisory Board recommending that the City Council direct staff to engage consultancy relative to obtaining regulatory approval for cost-effective ocean disposal of State Park Marina dredge material and or determine the practical and economic feasibility of using the same as landfill. Obviously related to the last one with the State Park Marina, we did engage consultancy. We did see a brief little glimmer of potential hope that we could piggyback onto the Corps project that is undergoing right now, or even have the Corps do our project as a local aid project and just pay them money and then they run the whole contracting. The regulatory body that was the gatekeeper to the environmental analysis to allow the dredge material disposal, our consultant determined that they could get about a 50-50 mix to put in the near shore, which is what they allowed before on a lesser volume. We were trying to go to the regulators to see if they'd take a 50-50 mix for the whole rest of the basin. Our consultant thought that they could come up with that with some creative deeper digging here where they know there's more sand and less digging where there's some silt, and get the mix to a 50-50 composition. EPA is the ultimate regulatory body over that, and we went to EPA with our consultant, and they weren't willing to consider our plus or minus 65,000-70,000 cubic yards in conjunction with the Corps' 280,000 cubic yards as one mass being dredged roughly at the same time. They wanted to look at it as separate projects, so they wanted our material to stand alone. and the cost to get through just the environmental testing, which would, I'm not an odds maker, but the odds were not good to pass the bioassay testing, not because the material is contaminated or toxic or poisonous. It's because it's silt and mud, and the testing that you use on the animals that live in the nearshore in the high energy, high oxygenated sandy surf zone don't survive in mud and silt. And so they're almost certainly going to die, and trying to get through that testing is a very high bar with very little likelihood of passing. And the cost to do that from our consultant was estimated at $178,000. So at that point, we pulled the plug and said, and plus time crunch with the Corps coming, even though the disc contractor came a little later than what we had anticipated, there's just no way to get that testing done in time. And the cost to do that, we just made the executive decision that was just too much money to gamble on a definite maybe. So that one hasn't gone anywhere. As I spoke earlier about CMANC and going back to Washington, D.C., and trying to talk to EPA and the Corps in the 80-20 rule, both the Corps and the EPA are at least willing to talk about it and see where it came from and see if there's some modern light that can be put on it, because as we all know, tens of thousands of tons of silt are flowing out our rivers right now, and they're not on our beaches, making our beaches muddy and sandy and or muddy and silty. That silt material goes out to the deeper environment where it belongs, because that's where it naturally goes. So hopefully we'll get some relief out of that, but that's yet to be seen. Any questions on that one? Drink of water. Finally, final recommendation was that the city, from the Harbor Advisory Board, the City Council approve issuance of a final draft Marine Services Facility Boatyard Request for Qualifications document. Ta-da! It was done. They approved it. So, that's the end of my report.
Gene, any questions or comments?
Yeah, a comment back on the aquarium proposal. I sat down with Planning Department several months ago discussing some of my concerns with the initial proposal for the aquarium. It did not meet the majority of the Waterfront Master Guidelines, recommendations, and guidelines. And the comment back I heard was that they're going to spend $11 million, and so we can waive several of those requirements. And that really bothers me. They're not going to provide any parking. They're not going to provide any in-lieu fee for parking. They're over scale, over bulk. I just have some concerns on this project.
So the project is in pre-concept stage. It's got a long way to go. It is recognized that there are some exceptions they're going to have to ask for if they try and go to the size and bulk and scale that they want to, and yet to be determined what public benefit findings will be to justify that, but that's all yet to be seen. It goes through the whole process.
And how will those public, who and how will those public benefits be assessed?
I believe, I'm not the planner, but I believe when an exception to any code is asked for or needed, findings of public benefit must be made, and those are generally made by the planning folks, the permitting folks, I think working with the applicant to determine what those public benefits are going to be, but it becomes a finding of public benefit, and then that was staff comes up with those findings working with the applicant, and then eventually goes to the Planning Commission, and Planning Commission makes a determination whether that's an acceptable finding or not. If they uphold it, then eventually those things can move on to the City Council, and the City Council looks at it the same way. Or if they say thumbs down and they don't agree with the findings, then staff and the applicant go back to the drawing board and work on them some more.
Councilman? Please.
Gene, your point about the size, bulk, and scale in the parking is very well noted, I think. One thing to think of in terms of harbor, and another thing the city's doing right now, is the downtown waterfront plan. and envisioning and coming to grips, working with all kinds of different stakeholders and looking at the flow of the Embarcadero and Market Street and connecting to downtown. Parking is a huge issue. I mean, that Front Street parking lot, you know, and there's been some plans of thinking, because all along that Embarcadero, in terms of increasing pedestrian traffic, if we lose parking spaces, not just for the aquarium, but writ large for that entire length, okay, do we build a parking structure? How can that parking structure, if we do would build one, and this is all ifs, this isn't for sure, this is just when we talk about that aquarium, because even if that was smaller, we can just imagine the bulk of people are going to be coming, the buses. I mean, how are we going to manage that traffic pattern in that small space? So I don't think looking at the aquarium as an isolated case is the way to go. I think we have to look at the entire Embarcadero downtown plan and envision that flow of traffic. And
I understand your point. I'm just trying to keep a level playing field for the leaseholders.
No, especially on that on the bay side of the Embarcadero, you're absolutely right. And so that's just one of those, another, you know, things to consider as we go through all of that. So I just wanted to bring up, instead of looking at it in a very, you know, one leaseholder, but also looking at it in the bigger picture also.
Thank you. Jeremiah?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask Eric, if were you aware that the 13th of this month is when the grant proposals are due into the cable liaison?
No, I hadn't heard they had set that. Lori had been keeping track of it, but thank you for that.
Yeah, okay.
Lynn, anything about the staff report? Neil? Okay, good. Eric, thank you, and thanks for this matrix about status of HAB recommendations. It's very hopeful.
Does that look about right?
Yes.
Any other input on it? Thumbs up, thumbs down. So next time, if there's what I would envision, if I had some kind of an update on there, I may put some kind of a little break in the box or something to indicate, just so it's not just a big, long-running dialogue, but then I'd add something in there and make it a running...
Well,
status.
What I mean, we all have access, and the public has access to all of these published agendas. What about just providing a current update at the time of publication?
Okay, I'll play with it a little bit.
It could be that the language is the same because the status is the same. That's entirely possible. But
okay.
I think we can track the status over time. Okay, thank you. So that brings us to business item C1, update from the Marine Services Facility Boatyard Ad Hoc Committee. And the chair is not here this evening. Is someone going to speak for that committee?
I spoke to Dana this week and wasn't anything to update other than RFQ going out.
Okay, I do have as it relates to that agenda item, I have a question for you, Eric. The Harbor Office circulated to the board some information about Philbrook's Boatyard in Sydney, B.C. recently. What was the intended purpose of that, please?
That came from Pandora Nash Carner when she came at our last meeting and joined the ad hoc committee. That was information she gathered up in the boatyard that she frequents.
So that's a submittal from the committee to the board?
Yeah. She wanted all of you to have.
Well, then she's a member of the committee, so that's a submittal from the committee to the board.
Yep.
Okay, good. Thanks. Okay.
Yep.
All right, moving along. C2, update from the Finance and Budget Ad Hoc Committee.
Good evening. So I have a report here, and we will be accessing a slideshow that Eric has attached over here. This is the Morro Bay budget forecast. Excuse me. Got it. What's up?
They're ahead of me.
Your mic is on. Okay. So, but first, I'll start. We have not met in person as a group since the last HAB meeting. However, I've had a phone meeting with Eric, And Ron was also present for the City Council work session that just occurred this past Tuesday, February 28th, at the Vets Hall, in which Bob Leland, who works with Management Partners Consulting, presented the 10-year budget forecast. And that's what this slideshow will go over. For the city. but before we get into that report, first I wanted to ask the harbor director where the city was at with the budget cycle. And this is kind of a three-part question. So where the city's at with the budget cycle, what dates will be significant for the Harbor Advisory Board to be aware of in regards to the budget? And finally, what specifically can the ad hoc committee assist the city with?
Okay, I'll try and answer to the best of my ability. I might lean on Matt over there a little bit too for some dates. So we are into the budget cycle, just started into the budget cycle. The first two components were budget workshops and really tweaking the Bob Leland budget model. That's what last Tuesday was. The meeting before, I think it was back in January, was the first look at that model and a glimpse of the future. The model wasn't fine-tuned as it is now. I've given the finance director and Bob a fair amount of input with some help from the ad hoc and some questions from the ad hoc and fine-tuned the modeling. There are some incorrect assumptions in there, and there are some funny numbers in there. There's still a couple little anomalies I still need to figure out. But for the most part, it looks like it is forecasting relatively accurate as you can get a budget forecast and predicting how much money you're going to make and spend in the future. So I'm reasonably...
Excuse me, but just to be clear, you're now talking about the Harbor Fund.
Yes, Harbor Fund.
As opposed to the citywide.
Yes, I'm not talking about General Fund or any other
Thank
funds.
You.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. So yeah, this is all just Harbor Fund. So it looks to be forecasting correctly. It's an interesting tool to work with. So I appreciate the ad hoc committee's input on that, and we'll continue to seek ad hoc committee's input. I don't know the dates, and that's where I'm going to lean on Matt if he knows off the top of my head on the next budget workshop or budget preparation schedule. I know we as department heads are starting to put together our numbers and getting our forecasting together and getting our expensing together and starting to look at master fee schedule, which we'll be doing through the month of March, and then into April we'll start submitting things to finance, and then we'll bat things back and forth and eventually get up in the council. I think we're trying to approve the budget in May, if not June, so at the latest. I know we don't want to go too far into June because then you're getting close to the fiscal year. So that's kind of schedule-wise. I apologize. I don't have the hard dates. I can email them to you when the council meetings are that consider budgets and when the workshops are. I think we've got one more workshop coming. I'm just looking at the staff report from our study session to see if it had anything in there, but it was just all 10-year forecast stuff.
And then the final part of that was, what specifically can the ad hoc committee assist you with, or with the city with?
All right, so I think what I'd be looking for the ad hoc is, and as we'll go through these slides here in a few minutes, capital, you know, my operating budget I don't need a ton of help on. Looking at revenues is and revenue assumptions is something that I will seek input from the committee on. Really the big nut to crack is capital. We're just barely on the positive side for revenues over expenses at this point, post-recession, and Dynegy being gone, power plant shutting down. We're starting to eke out and starting to make a little bit more money, but we're not making money hand over fist. So we're going to be still revenue limited on what we can do with capital. So we really need to look at this forecast tool. Assuming we've got a good, accurate model, looking out 5 years, which is, you know, a little more certain than out beyond 5 years, and really see what our revenue curve is going to be and how much we're going to be putting in accumulation, and then look at the capital needs against it and prioritize where we're going to focus our capital needs. Obviously, until we get revenues up significantly, new revenue streams, retire the South T Pier loan, $134,000 a year, and get some more revenue over expenses, we're going to be limited. We're not going to be able to meet all of our capital needs, as we well know. So. And that's true with the city as well. We're looking at not a bleak picture. We're not in great shape, in the city's general fund, but we're not as bleak as a lot of cities, and a lot of cities aren't even really sure how bleak they are because they're not studying us quite as much as we are. So the city is trying to implement some policies and procedures and initiatives to get revenues up, because nobody wants to tax their way out of a hole. The only other way out is to cut services, and nobody wants to do that either. So we're all working on this puzzle trying to get our revenues up and keep our expenses under control.
You did a good job of talking, Eric. I look. I can look up the calendar. In terms of the budget forecasting, we have in terms of the city, we have a budget forecast, another one on March 22nd. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Nope, it was last year. The next budget we have May 9th. We just had one budget forecast on the 28th. The next one is May 9th, May 23rd, and May 30th. These are all different budgets, and the idea is working towards finalizing it before June with the oncoming next fiscal year.
And is the Harbor Fund and the Harbor Department involved in all three of those forecasts?
I would think, because the majority of it's going to be the large picture is going to be the general budget, and I would think that the Harbor is going to be playing their fair share within that. I don't necessarily think it's just going to be Harbor and the city general fund. It'll be with all the different departments.
But I believe we'll be involved in all those, one way, shape, or form.
And as Eric's talking about in terms of this budget forecast, looking at the shortfall with the state retirement systems adjusting, Morro Bay, I do believe, and if you've been following the papers, San Luis has just in the past couple of days come out in that, oh, wow, you know, this is going to be on the agenda, where all these municipalities are going to have to get out and take care of this with the state retirement system adjusting downward in terms of what the state will be contributing to the retirement system for employees. Morro Bay, although it's not in the paper, I think we've done a fairly decent job of getting out in front of it and getting the different stakeholders involved and saying this is what we have to adjust for and the shortfall. And so looking at that budget forecast, we have a 10-year budget forecast. It's not exact science, and I'm by no means an expert at this, but as I listen to it, I'm like, okay, this makes sense. At least you're looking at it going, okay, this is what the prognosis could be if the pattern of the economic patterns continue, and that includes downturns in the economy, which they're predicting, I think it was 2019. And through the cyclical affair in the last, 70, 80 years. So I feel we're on pretty decent grounds budget-wise to at least understand that we're going to have a shortfall. But then on the flip side of that, what we're just in terms of optimism, let's be positive. We could be positive here. What Gene was just alluding to with the aquarium and then me coming up here and talking about the downtown waterfront plan. If we can collectively, between the advisory boards, Harbor, in your capacity, the city, somehow attract other revenue building coming into the city and to mitigate that $400,000. Along with that, a lot of people are just willy-nilly going, well, let's build more rooms for more motels. But we understand, too, in the economic downturn of 2007, 2008, if we put too many eggs in the basket for tourism, we're also putting ourselves too far out there. And the same would go for fishing. You can't necessarily put everything in terms of Measure D, building one part of the Embarcadero for only one industry. So looking at it in a larger sense, in that bigger sense of the city, it's like, okay, how can we adjust for this shortfall? So I think we can. We're out in front of it enough to that we can get all the different parties involved to say, okay, what's your idea, et cetera, down the line, and piece by piece maybe work our way out of this. I feel very certain as a council member, last year when we started talking about the adjustment rates for retirement plans for our fire and our police and our city employees, last year we had a very decent plan looking ahead for the next 25 years. These state retirement systems are adjusting higher, but Morro Bay were out, I think, sufficiently that it's going to spike for, I think it was 4 or 5 years, if you remember, Eric. And then it was like, okay, we're going to work ourselves out of this, like the early 20s through the 20s, into the 30s, the 2030s, I mean. Now with this latest downturn of the retirement system, it's like, all right, this is going to put another kink in the wire. So it's just going to take more collective action, us working together to go, all right, how can we do that? An alternative, and I don't think anybody here would want that, is we start cutting services. We save that $400,000 from police, fire, or whatever, whoever we're going to lay off. But we're all interested in Morro Bay enough that I don't think that that's a valid way to go. So with what I guess I'm giving you too much information, sorry. But I think when you guys, and that's why it's so important with the work you do, is like, all right, let's think of all these different things, not just piecemeal, but collectively.
Mr. Makowetsky, you mentioned $400,000 deficit moving forward annually. It's accumulating, according to Mr. Lee, according to Management Partners, and I heard the city manager use the same number. I also thought I heard Mr. Leland talk about $650,000.
And, Ron, I think looking at the economic model that he's talking about, and again, I do not want to claim any sort of expertise on this. I've just been over it a few times, so I'm getting somewhat comfortable with it. I think that number can and will adjust according to some years. It could start out at $400,000 and go up to a certain level. I think they built in a gray area that our retirement expenditures right now are right around $1 million or $1.5 million, and they can adjust up to that $2-2.5 million. So it could fluctuate depending on if the percentage that the city is paying will be paying, or the state retirement system is going to be paying for those retirements. It's adjusting down from 7.5% now to 7.
Yeah, I think the difference, I think you're quite correct, sir, and I think the difference was the predicted discount rate.
Yes.
From CalPERS.
Yes.
I think that was it.
And the 650 was heading towards 6.
Yes. And
the 400 is 7,
and that's looking so. Out, I think it was at least 10 years before it would get to that 6. But however, that's going to be a significant amount of money for any municipality, let alone ours. I mean, we're working with a budget of $12.5 million now. And that if we have a budget of an ever 600, that's just to keep our heads above water, let alone paying, you know, fair, decent wages to our employees, doing a physical upkeep of our public infrastructure, et cetera, including harbor. So that's why when we're looking at, can we attract other industries, including tourism, to Morro Bay, and to, you know, grow that economic pie somewhat to preserve the quality of life and quantity of life that we enjoy here in Morro Bay.
And to tag onto that a little bit, I think you're correct. It was the PERS rate. So if people don't understand how it works, and I'm definitely no expert on it, but the amount any given agency pays into the retirement system for their employees depends largely on what PERS makes on all the money they have in their bank held for everybody's retirements. And the more money they make, the less you have to pay into it, and vice versa. One of the reasons we got into the problem we're into is back in the day when the economy was getting ready to burst, when the bubble was getting bigger and bigger, PERS was making so much money on their money that there was a lot of agencies that were called superfunded. They weren't having to pay anything, and that they believed they could go into that in the future, and decisions were made based on that kind of rate of return, and then the bubble popped and we all come crashing down. So that's where that rate of return changes the city's financial picture. It's not a fixed number that you have to pay into the retirement systems.
Nicely done.
Thank you.
Oh, really? Nicely done. Thank you. Matt, thank you.
All right, back to my report. So we were unable to meet with Craig. I'm going to mess his name up. Schmollinger, is that correct? He's the new finance director, to discuss the cost allocation study. But I have spoken with Eric, and he is attempting to schedule a meeting during the second week in March. Correct?
Correct.
Okay. So now up here on the slide over here, we have the pages that we focused on out of the City Council's work session. This is a report from Management Partners regarding the city, but we focus on pages 10 through 12 and pages 20 through 22, which pertain directly to the Harbor Fund's budget forecast. And so this sheet that's up here is page 20. I can't even read that, but actually it's on mine. Hold on.
If you want to tell me which ones you want to go to, Neil, I can.
The one that it's on right now is actually perfect to start. That's page 20. The most important facts, or one of the more important facts that stands out on this graph, is that it only includes previously approved budgeted capital projects. And this suggests that it doesn't take into account any future needs of the harbor. This chart looks very optimistic in the long term. As you see where it starts to just go up and up and up, that's using Bob Leland's tool that projects somewhat in a straight line, as Eric's spoken about in the past, for the accumulated fund, correct. And it'll show, there's a box in the, that yellow box in the middle right there, if you can't read that, that says funds accumulating for future projects, and that's in the year 2021 on this graph. So other than that, until then, that means that we are in the red in the accumulation fund. We won't be taking any money. And I'm going to circle back because I know you're going to want to say something.
No, that's fine. Okay. No, that's great. So that curve right in the where it's at the lowest down there is right where we are now. It's actually,
right,
in reality, going to a little lower than that. Beyond this fiscal year, that the where the curves go up, they're assuming no more capital funding. They're assuming we're spending what we have now, which is somewhere in the neighborhood of $700,000 with the projects we have on the books. If we spend those all down right now, that's what we'll build back up if we don't do any more spending. So that's
right,
where the balance is going to need to be made, where I spoke earlier, where we've got some increase, we're starting to see some light. Now we've got to get our capital spreadsheet and put it against that, against the forecasting tool, and really use the tool as Ron, I'm sure you saw it the other day. It's a pretty amazing spreadsheet that you can adjust, you know, TOTs, you know, goes up 1%, or you've got 10 more percent of rooms than you had before, and plug that into the model, and it changes all the numbers all across all the different charts and graphs and everything. So it's got the same thing with the harbor. It's a lot simpler model, but we can play with that as a committee and look at revenue and expense and capital and start plugging things in, and you can watch those graphs, and it ends up being a good tool to kind of keep you within the lines.
But so as we, if we were to lay over that, you know, all the capital requirements, that graph would no longer look like that. It would give us a realistic image of what our annual budget is forecasted,
right,
out for what we need to spend and what we've gone over with you to prioritize spending on and need to,
right,
revisit, obviously, to prioritize before the actual spending occurs, but that's correct?
Yeah, correct. The first budget workshop we had where Bob had the model and they had the update on it, it had assumed, it basically plugged in our capital, what I call the wish list, the things that I lined out for the next 10 years that if money were no object, this is what we'd do. He plugged that in, and it very quickly went into the red, and then all of a sudden we're borrowing from the general fund, and then it bleeds over into the general fund model, and the general fund model all falls apart because we're dragging them down. Well, that wasn't the case. We corrected that. That was one of those things we talked about in that model, the garbage in, garbage out. We got to make sure that we've got the right information going into his model so his model feeds everything else correctly.
And that got corrected since the meeting?
Correct.
On the 28th?
Yes. Yeah, the meeting, this came out of the 28th meeting, and this,
okay,
is the corrected model. Like I said, there's still a couple of little anomalies I'm trying to drill down on and figure out, but I haven't seen anything huge that makes things look really, really great or really, really bad. It looks like we're pretty on track.
All right. Can you go to page 10, which is the actual chart? That's City of Morro Bay Harbor Funds budget forecast. Begins with operations.
Is that, let me see, I'm going to get the paper version of it. Is that just kind of like a big spreadsheet looking?
It's this right here.
This one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you say that's page 10. Is that going to be backwards on this or forwards? That's got to be backwards.
That's forward.
Actually, it is forward, yeah, because it had all the other funds. Oh, that was too fast. Is that it? Nope, that's not it. I don't want that. I'll go backwards. No, it was more forward. I think I whizzed way past it.
Yeah, it was the first
few
pages.
Yeah, I think it was in the beginning.
Just close your eyes, Gene.
Well, maybe it's not on here. It might have been a different slide that's not on this. Well, we could put it in the overhead. It's not in here.
How convenient.
I thought it was. No, it's not in here. This is where we start. That's us, that's us, that's us.
What's that? What's that? That's not it, no.
That's the next page.
Oh, yeah.
Let me put it on the overhead?
If you can, because there's some pretty important.
AGP.
No, Gene, you got your laser pointer? Oh, dang it.
AGP.
Do you have a laser pointer?
AGP.
Just we'll do this page for right now. All right. So where, if you were a laser pointer, where would you be? Ah. Gotta be smarter than the tool. I see it turn on. Okay, there we go.
Don't look into it.
Yeah, right? Okay. I've done this before. Okay, so this is page 10 for those of you at home. On the Morro Bay Harbor Fund's budget forecast shows that in fiscal year 2016, there's a negative $16,000 balance. All right, buddy. Right there. For some reason, it doesn't want to stay on. So that negative $16,000 balance was a question that I had when I spoke with Eric. And then the following year, there's a zero balance right here. And then we start getting into these deeper in the forecast, and you can start to they start to just climb dramatically. And so my question was, is this $16,000 here?
Neil, would you read off the line item description, please?
Yeah, sorry. That is the beginning, or that is the ending balance for fiscal year 2016. So the question was, is this a real number as we're approaching the end of fiscal year? And the harbor director explained that the forecasting tool assumes everything on the capital list gets spent and calculates based on that. The harbor director states, the calculator that Bob Leland produced looks at everything that's on the capital list and puts that in, but the harbor director actually starts the year looking at what's in the bank account and uses that to determine what he's going to spend, so he will never actually go into the red. And so this isn't a realistic approach, and Eric might speak to that a little more eloquently since that's his.
Yeah, now that I looked at that, and I was driving on the road when Neil was tell me about this, so I wasn't sure exactly what line he's looking at. But now that I look at that, that bottom line down there is revenues over expenses. There's one year that looks like it goes into, what is it, $16,000 negative. That might have been last year. That doesn't sound right because we haven't been negative other than 2000. Well, we weren't negative. We had to rely on the Dynegy outfall lease money that we weaned ourselves off of. We never had to go into our accumulation that I was aware of to get our operating budget balance. But according to the numbers he's got, we had to dip into reserves to the amount of $16,000, zeroed out. Is that this year's line?
That's 2016.
So then on forward, it starts to show accumulation balances. That's the accumulation fund. Basically, that's revenues over expenses. That excess money in the bottom down there in the positive, those would eventually go over into the accumulation fund. There's basically two places we keep excess cash. One is in our operating budget. We make $1,000 in revenue and we have $900 in expenses, we made $100. That stays in my operating fund until eventually it moves over into the accumulation fund, which is an interest-bearing account. Those numbers are what would be at the end of the operating budget each year if the money wasn't thrown back over into the accumulation fund, is what that looks like to me.
Okay.
So I'll have to look back on that one year that's negative because that doesn't look right to me.
But. Well, just I have a quick question. So are those real numbers that are up there? Are they believable numbers? What's the level of confidence in those numbers as they project out and they turn from tens of thousands into hundreds of thousands?
My confidence level is pretty good. They, you know, the last few years we've had good revenues over expenses. We're not out of the woods by any means. But the zero and the one and the negative concerns me a little bit, but those were based, I'd have to see what data went into those. But going into the future, we have revenues over expenses very modestly, and then 5 or 6 years out is when we lose the South T-Pier loan. That's done. So things should start ramping up even further after that. So the out years, the future years, assume a modeling, and I've looked at that modeling pretty closely and corrected what I thought were some errors in some of those assumptions that Bob had, and I'm reasonably confident he's on the right track with forecasting our revenues. And he's just, you know, we had a few years after the economic downturn where, you know, I was forecasting revenues above expenses. You know, next year is going to be 20% above, and it's actually 30. I mean, we're doing some crazy leaps for a couple of years there. We're plateaued out. You know, we've basically climbed back up where we were before the economic downturn, so now we've plateaued out, and it was hard to forecast for a while there. But now that we've got the advantage of hindsight, we can see what happened. I've got pretty good confidence that his number forecasting is good, and it'll always be fine-tuned as you go along.
And do you know whether this particular model, the model for this spreadsheet, incorporates or does not incorporate Mr. Leyland's predicted recession?
I believe it should. I think he's got that in 19 now. Yeah, that sounds right.
So when I looked at this chart and I saw the ending balances in negative 16,000 and zero, that was a little more alarming to me. And as I've spoken with Ron about this as well, I think we shared this concern about the need for the city, for the enterprise fund, I'll say, to find other ways to generate income to start making up for this deficit. It needs to be an important goal that we take on. And what I'm hearing from you is less concern for that need. But would I be correct in saying that? That because you were saying that you feel fine with these numbers. It's hard for me to believe that if we're plateaued right now and we're coming out of a plateau to start seeing these increases, $202,000 in 2018, and then a recession hits, and then we go up to $438,000 of going into the fund, and then $661,000. They just seem like continuing climbing up to $1.8 million, then $2.1 million. If I was looking at my company's books, I'd think that we're doing fantastic. That's pretty optimistic in my book.
His modeling doesn't, in terms of CPIs and other sort of inflationary factors, his model's pretty conservative. Having looked at his charts with our major revenue streams, with leases and our boating stuff, commercial fishing stuff, they're not wildly optimistic forecasts by any means. They're fairly conservative. We've got some new leases coming online as some of these old ones retire, and we'll be getting better revenues out of those. So I'm reasonably confident those numbers. I'm a little concerned about that zero and that negative, but that's something I need to look into, and that may affect everything else down the line. I don't know, but that's something I'm going to look into. But the model's getting fine-tuned pretty well, and we're getting zeroing in closer on it.
Okay. Just reiterating it because I want to make sure that we're
picture. I don't want to go budget into a year thinking, hey, we're going to put $600,000 in the bank this year and go plan on spending that. We certainly don't want to do that. So, no, I want to be good on it, too.
Right. And then, again, we got to reiterate that this does not take into account any of the capital requirements. So if you laid over year by year the capital requirement schedule that we've put together, that's the equipment, maintenance, and all that that would adjust these numbers too, correct?
Correct.
Okay. See what page we need to go to. So I wasn't at the meeting, but Ron was, and so the city manager made a comment that given the city's 10-year budget forecast, the harbor fund zone will not likely access the city's general fund. And so if we were in a zero, like you said before, we had to dip into the general fund. Was that the general fund that we had to dip into to zero things out? Would we not have access to that again?
Well, we borrowed money from the general fund back in the early 90s, right as I got here, we were just finishing up a loan from the general fund. We've never taken any general fund money since then. That was Bob Leland's budget model because it had all that capital wish list plugged into it, and it made us go negative. It wouldn't let us spend out of thin air, so it took it automatically from the general fund. It was assuming the general fund would subsidize us.
Okay.
That hasn't occurred, and is not going to occur.
Okay.
If I have anything to say about it.
Okay, so we can assume that in a year where there's zero, that no vital services would be cut, there just wouldn't be any expenditure in the capital requirements. Is that a safe assumption?
I would intend to never dip into accumulation fund, our capital improvement fund, basically, for operational monies. We came close a couple of years when we lost Dynegy, but we got past that, and then the recession turned around. It's like going into your emergency reserve. You don't want to operate out of your emergency reserve for annual needs. The capital is for excess revenues to go into to do the big projects, and your operating fund should match expenses and exceed expenses so that you can put money away. So I would never plan a budget to start eating, and unless it was a dire emergency for some anomaly. You know, we don't want to go into the accumulation fund for operational. That's bad.
So I think we touched on this on our phone conversation, having a general percent that of the budget that we keep in the bank possibly for the harbor for that rainy day, because I look at this and you say conservative, but I'm a farmer and I'm ultra conservative, and I have to stow away from that rainy day, and I don't see, you know, a contingency for, like you said, that rainy day.
So moving into the future, now that we are revenue above expense, albeit not by a lot, we're revenue above expense and that curve starts going up, I believe we as a department need to establish a minimum accumulation fund parameter. Because accumulation fund is an emergency reserve. It's really our capital improvement fund and our equipment fund, but it's also emergency reserve. And it's prudent for us to have an extra set of cash laying around in case the tsunami or something really big and bad happens. We need some extra money. We need to establish what that minimum amount would be, and then from there, there's your baseline. And then once you start building up from there is when you start working on your capital projects. That would be my intent to move forward and working with the committee to try and start designing that and tweaking the model to look at the inputs both on revenues and expenses and capital and start making it work for us and make it as a planning tool.
Okay. Just a few other quick points on these spreadsheets. Observations, and I know this is a forecasting tool, which I'm not completely familiar with this, but there's numerous line items that begin with actual numbers, and then they show extreme variation within the numbers that exist, and I'll point to a few. But then after the next, after 4 years, they just turn into zeros. For example, the adjustments, cash adjustments, transfers in, and revenue from equipment. If I can get this thing to work again. So, for example, right here, transfers in, that number right there is 305,000. Then it goes to zero, then to 93,000, 41,000, and then zeros. And there's depreciation.
So on that last line you went over, I think those are actuals. So until it happens going into the future, you're not going to have anything?
Yeah.
What those numbers are... Transfer in could be a lot of things. Could be grants, zeroing out grant expenses would be my educated guess on that one. I'd have to look and see because it is wild. It's all over the place. You said 301 and 40 on another.
Right.
They're all over the map. and it's obviously not anything consistent that looks to be growing or shrinking. I think those are probably grant reimbursement type things, or yeah, that would be what I would think they would be.
Neil, I have a suggestion to move this along, okay. And that is that you, as the chair of the committee, get together with Eric, satisfy yourself as to the answers to your questions, and give him an opportunity to satisfy himself.
Perfect.
And then bring it back on the next committee report.
Good with that.
Okay. I would like to reiterate something that Neil said in his report, and that is that one clear, reiterate for the board here, one clear thing that I heard from the city manager during the forecast report, management partners forecast report on Tuesday, was that given that the city in general is faced with a projected significant deficit, which Councilman Makowiecki has addressed this evening, that the enterprise zones, for instance, the Harbor Fund, which is an enterprise zone, are going to have to stand on their own financially. So that really got my attention. I mean, I should have known that, actually, but I suppose, because I think that's a basic policy of the city in any case. But it really got my attention. So one of the things that this board needs to help, I think, the department look at it with the leadership of the department is what can be done relative to enhancing revenue for the Harbor Fund as it moves forward through the next several years. And one of the constraints to that, and this is a personal opinion of mine, so I'm not speaking for the committee or the board, one of the constraints to that are the existing lease agreements, which are extremely varied in their terms. Not only the length of them, which some of them are very protracted, but the basic revenue terms within each one of them are very different, or relatively different from one to the other. And I don't know what, if anything, can be done about that, but it's something that I would encourage the ad hoc committee to discuss with the department and see what can be done. So, for that committee's report, any questions or comments? Gene? Jeremiah? Lynn? Okay. Thank you, Neil. And thank you, Matt. And thank you, Eric. Okay. So that takes us to C4, update from the Marine Sanctuary Ad Hoc Committee on the committee's recent activities. I'm still the chair of that, so I'll do the report as soon as I get down through a bunch of paper here. As the committee reported in the last meeting, the county supervisors addressed the issue of the proposed Chumash National Heritage Marine Sanctuary proposal. And during their February 7th meeting, they voted to approve a resolution opposing creation of that particular proposed sanctuary off our portion of the California coast. Supervisors made, I think, some very relevant comments relative to before folks freak out completely, those that are in favor of sanctuaries, this particular one. The resolution, this Board of Supervisors resolution, stated in part that, quote, several stakeholders expressed opposition to the sanctuary's creation, end quote, and stated that the Board of Supervisors opposes the sanctuary, and the supervisors stated that they oppose the sanctuary, quote, in part due to concerns about the loss of local control. It's also important to note that before the vote, Supervisor Compton added an amendment to their resolution, reaffirming the board's commitment to Measure A, that's County Measure A, which was approved by voters in 1986. That measure requires a public vote before the county can approve a permit for development of onshore facilities to support offshore oil and gas development. And during this discussion, prior to the vote, the Board of Supervisors and then in their resolution noted that there are multiple layers of federal, state, and local laws already in place to serve to protect California's coast without the need for a federal marine sanctuary designation. And as the board knows, and for the public that's interested, if you pull up the agenda for this particular meeting, there are some attachments to this particular agenda item. One of those attachments is a list of existing federal, state, and local protections relative to the ocean environment. And there are multiple federal protections in place, multiple state protections in place, and some local protections. Measure A that I just talked about from the county, and I think Jeremiah has, who's on this committee, Jeremiah has some information about a city one as well. Also, you'll find attached to this agenda item an article that came out of an online environmental well-regarded news outlet that is very, very environmentally oriented. The title is "Trump Seeks More Oil Drilling in California." That's not so easy. Irrespective of any of the names involved in this, the point of the article was that these are environmentalists who are pointing out that it would be very difficult to engage in offshore oil and gas development irrespective of a sanctuary because of the existing protections that are already in place. So that's it for me. Jeremiah is the only other member this evening here from this committee. Jeremiah, comments?
Would you like me to read any parts of the I do have Measure A here, and also an Ordinance 45 Ordinance 445.
They're brief. Please read them into the record.
So the Measure A, an ordinance adopted by the county on November 4th, 1986. No permit, entitlement, lease, or other authorization of any kind within the county of San Luis Obispo would authorize or allow the development, construction, installation, or expansion of any onshore support facility for offshore oil and gas activity shall be final unless such authorization is approved by a majority of the votes cast by a vote of the people of the county of San Luis Obispo in general or special election for the purpose of this ordinance. The term onshore support facility means any land use, installation, or activity required to support the exploration, development, production, storage, processing, transportation, or related activities of offshore energy resources. Energy and Industrial Development, July 2004, Coastal Plan, 2004-4-2, Coastal Plan Policies Summary, Section 2, authorizations obtained from the county after January 1, 1986, shall be subject to the provisions of this ordinance. Section 3, if any section, sentence, clause, phrase, or part of this ordinance shall be held invalid by any court of competent jurisdiction, the remaining provisions of the ordinance shall be given full effect consistent with the intent and purpose of the ordinance, enacted by voter initiative Measure A. Now, that was the county on Measure A, and we have the a provision by the city of Morro Bay, which we are the major port, that any work on offshore facilities would more than likely have to work out of this port. And it reads, there shall be no construction, reconstruction, operation, or maintenance of any commercial or industrial facility within the city, including but not limited to businesses or personal office, oil or gas storage facilities, pipe, drilling, or materials or equipment repair or storage facilities, or any other aid or support which operates directly or indirectly in support of any offshore oil or gas exploration, development, drilling, pumping, or production. Nor shall there be any construction, reconstruction, operation, or maintenance of any pipeline within the city for the transmission of any oil or natural gas taken or removed from any offshore oil or gas or pumping operation. A, zone changes, no zoning changes to accommodate onshore support facilities for offshore oil or gas exploration, development, drilling, pumping, or production shall be enacted without a vote of the people of the city. Ordinance, the ordinance shall be codified in this chapter and shall not be amended or repealed without a vote of the people. So it's pretty remote that anybody would be operating on or out of this port, I believe.
So that's the committee's report. So, Neil, comments, questions?
No, I think that was very thorough. I was interested to see this list you guys compiled of all the other regulations, because up until now I just heard of a list, but it seems like it's pretty well documented. So that's it.
Lynn?
Yes, Jeremiah, on that first one that you read, the Measure A, does that say energy or is it limited to petroleum? Energy would be the wind farm as well, if, but.
I think it's anything oil.
I thought I heard oil and gas activity. Okay.
It does, it's okay. So it does say oil and gas activity, and then down here it says or related activities of offshore energy resources.
Offshore energy resources.
Well, the keyword is related. Oil and gas development, quote, related, unquote.
I think it would be subject to interpretation here.
Okay.
Probably.
That's only one part out of the whole list.
I think reading the first part, it appears that they're talking about support of offshore oil and gas.
So, Councilman, if you think it's appropriate, given that the city is engaged in dialogue with some offshore non-gas and oil potential energy producers, if you think it's appropriate, it would be interesting to see whether that dialogue is underway in consideration of the county's Measure A.
I would definitely.
Thank you. Thank you. Gene? Okay. Anything else on this agenda item? No? Good. Thank you. Okay. So moving along, that brings us to C5, update from the Working Waterfront Ad Hoc Committee. Gene?
Our Ad Hoc Committee...
Actually, excuse me. I apologize. It appears to me that this agenda item actually has two elements to it. Were you going to address the two separate elements?
Separately.
Yeah. Yes.
Do you want to have staff report first?
No, not the staff report. What I was thinking was that one element appears to relate directly to the committee's consideration of Morro Bay designating a working waterfront.
Yes.
And the second element appears to address, maybe that's exactly what you meant, appears to address the Measure D question.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, on the first item, our ad hoc committee met this week. Danny provided us with additional information as to the importance of working waterfront and its application in various cities and waterfronts throughout the nation. As of today, we've not heard from any city consultant in regards to general plan updates, nor its inclusion in a working waterfront application. Both of our committee's members, all three of us, have been working on a draft resolution, and I'll give you a copy or a quick scenario of that resolution. Morro Bay has a working waterfront, a land use type slowly being replaced across the county by businesses, industry, and housing that is not dependent on a deep harbor or efficient access to the ocean. Morro Bay's working waterfront has finite land space, and its waterfront land is therefore scarce and precious. To fulfill our obligation to the City's Council's goals and objective direction to define and implement a working waterfront designation and to preserve it, the vibrant history and benefit of Morro Bay's working waterfront, the Morro Bay Harbor Advisory Board recommends that the City Council officially self-designate our working waterfront by enacting a targeted resolution. Such a resolution and the land use measure to support it ensure continuation of the rich history of Morro Bay's working waterfront while supporting contributing uses of today and tomorrow while celebrating public access. Such a resolution demonstrates that within the approximately 2.5 miles long waterfront area, that there is room for water-dependent uses, water-related uses, commercial and recreational fishing-dependent uses, environmentally-dependent uses, and uses not specifically marine-related to coexist for the benefit of our community and our visitors. Working waterfront are often affected by external environmental, economic, and social forces that impact the function and vitality of its uses. These external forces cannot always be foreseen or planned for in the near term, so focused efforts towards planning for their future is necessary to maintain the purpose and vitality of this specialized area. Morro Bay's working waterfront designation best incorporates not only the present use, but future opportunities for economic development, such as offshore wind and wave energy projects, and other commercially opportunities that fit the character of Morro Bay's working waterfront. The Harbor Advisory Board further recommends that the resolution defines Morro Bay's working waterfront as extending from Target Rock in the north to the State Park Marina to the south, and that this are to be defined by three sectors. One sector would extend from Target Rock south to Beach Street and be designated for use related to commercial fishing and recreational fishing as currently defined on Measure D. We would also include the Dynegy property and the Triangle property in that sector. The next sector would extend from Beach Street south to the Tidelands Boat Launch area and would be designated for visitor serving, water-dependent commercial, water-related commercial, and environmental-related uses. The third sector would extend from Tidelands Park Boat Launch to the State Park Marina and would be designated for visitor serving, water-dependent, and water-related uses. At this point, we are formulating several implication policies, recommendations that provide and project and encourage future working waterfront activities. Just one of these policies may be have the council look at amending the master lease fee with a supplemental fee schedule. Usages that are wholly dependent on Bay Ocean waters shall have their lease fees reduced by maybe a percentage. Waterfront usages that are complementary to Bay Ocean activities shall have their lease fees remained as is, and waterfront usages that are non-dependent, non-complementary by the Bay Ocean shall have an additional percentage added to their lease fee. We are also exploring additional strategies that have been and are being incorporated in various locations around the nation. That's our first task. As opposed to Measure D area, my feeling on for us to define Measure D is going to be a long, drawn-out process. The Harbor Advisory Board had gone through this once before trying to define Measure D, and as Eric will testify, it's going to become a legal issue. So that's what I have on my report so far.
Okay, so going back to the first item, does the board have any questions? Working waterfront designation issue. Does the board have any comments or questions? Neil?
not at this time.
Lynn? Jeremiah?
Just sounded like you did a very good job. And I was very impressed. Very good job. It's a lot of work.
So, Gene, is it the... Did I hear you say that the committee is recommending to the Harbor Advisory Board that it recommend to the City Council that the City Council formulate and adopt a resolution self-designating a working waterfront as described in the committee's report for Morro Bay?
That's correct, and then also we need to implement some measures, some policies. That would be the council's direction.
Is it the committee's opinion that there's been a sufficient amount of work on this that the Harbor Advisory Board, if it adopts the committee's recommendation, is in a position to make a motion to recommend that the City Council adopt such a draft and adopt such a resolution?
And not at this point. I think we need at least one or two more meetings so we can flesh out what we'd like to see, some of the other strategies that we've seen and we're attempting to collect some additional ways to implement and protect our waterfront and enhance it.
Okay. So the second element, you've offered your comments about Measure D issue. Putting on my ad hoc committee member's hat, the first thing I think that would be useful is to, because it's only going to take 60 seconds, is to once again read into the record and for the memory of the public what Measure D says. This is in quotes. This is Measure D, which was passed by the citizens of Morro Bay in 1981 through a ballot measure. It was implemented as City Ordinance number 2017 and Morro Bay Municipal Code section 17.36.020. The city shall not grant any permit, authorization, or other approval of any state-owned tidelands subject to city lease between Beach Street and Target Rock unless such development or use is primarily for the purposes of serving or facilitating licensed commercial fishing activities or non-commercial recreational fishing activities or is clearly incidental thereto, period. For the purposes of illustration only and not by any way of limitation, no approval shall be granted for any new passenger for hire boats or supporting facilities or any new restaurant, cafe, gift shop, or other retail establishments serving the general public, and any existing such uses shall hereafter be considered non-conforming and shall not be expanded or enlarged, end quote. Measure D, as it exists today, forms the basis for the existing Local Coastal Plan Chapter 9, which is entitled Commercial Fishing and Recreational Boating. And because Measure D was implemented through a public ballot measure, the terms of Measure D, i.e. its text, if you will, can only be modified through another ballot measure. In other words, it cannot simply be reinterpreted or clarified to a point where its original provisions are subverted. The Harbor Advisory Board in recent months has identified and discussed that there appear to be a couple of ambiguities in the language for Measure D, and they revolve primarily around two points. The first reference is the word, quote, primarily, end quote, as it relates to allowable waterfront uses for the, quote, purposes of serving or facilitating licensed commercial fishing activities or non-commercial recreational activities, so primarily. The second reference is the words, quote, clearly incidental thereto, end quote, as they relate to these same allowable waterfront uses. So, what to do? What can the Harbor Advisory Board offer on the question of Measure D and the work that the city's engaged in currently on updating the general plan and the local coastal plan, short of recommending that the city introduce a ballot measure that modifies Measure D or removes Measure D or does something? And I have a couple of thoughts. Getting back to the two ambiguities that we've all been talking about and that the city struggles with, I think, Eric struggles with it or deals with it, and the Hill seems to struggle with it. The word principally, let's start with that briefly. So common synonyms for principally are essentially, mostly, chiefly. Those synonyms are usually used to define principally, and by definition, they're subjective. That's the difficulty. So one of the things that we learned from that, though, from those synonyms and the word, is that principally refers to a primary use, as opposed to a secondary or an accessory use. So looking up in the law dictionaries how the law treats the word principally, at least in that word form, a common legal definition, which is more quantitative, calls for a thing to be at least 51%. So, applying that standard to Measure D, allowable waterfront uses would have to be at least 51% for the purposes of serving or facilitating licensed commercial fishing activities or non-commercial recreational activities. So, on a practical basis, if the language of Measure D is not modified by ballot measure, it falls to the city to determine on a case-by-case basis whether proposed use of Measure D waterfront meets the standard, and that, if I'm not mistaken, Harbor Director, is how it's been dealt with. And he just nodded his head in the affirmative. So concerning, quote, clearly incidental there too, in my opinion, that's less problematic. A clear interpretation revolves around the word incidental, the common legal definition of which is something related to the main purpose or main thing. So in the case of Measure D, the main thing is using land in the Measure D area for purposes of serving or facilitating licensed commercial fishing activities or non-commercial recreational activities. Well, that seems pretty straightforward to me, especially when incidental, as it's written, is further clarified by the words clearly and thereto, as they relate to the waterfront purposes that are identified in Measure D. So I'm less concerned about the apparent ambiguity that's been identified by me and others, actually, of clearly incidental thereto. I think that's pretty straightforward. And it seems to me the essential issue relates around the principally point. Eric, let me ask you a question. Do you feel, and I'm going to put you on the spot, and I apologize for that, but I'm going to do it anyway. Do you feel that the Harbor Department, to which much of this interpretation falls on a case-by-case basis, has been able to deal with it successfully over time?
I do, with the caveat that on a case-by-case basis, it's not always crystal clear, it's not always perfect, and there's always angst, you know, up the hill, down the hill, sideways. It seems like it's never perfect. But as you state, we've implemented it, and as you further when opined there a second ago, until some sort of a legal challenge is brought or the measure is better defined, it's the interpretation of the day is what carries until it's challenged otherwise. And so how we've been implementing it so far has survived legal challenge. So yes, I'm been reasonably comfortable interpreting primarily, obviously that's the sticking point, 51%, you know, in recent times with the measuring stick that I've generally used is that 51% measuring stick, and but then which 51% rabbit hole do you go down? There's a couple of them. One is revenues. You've got a lease site that generates revenues from a number of sources. If 51% of the gross revenue generated off that site is Measure D compliant, can all of the other 49% be non-Measure D compliant? That's one way we looked at it. The other is just gross square footage, which on land can be stable and not so fluid, pardon my pun, but on the water, boats move and change, and so how do you assign a square footage to it? So it's been a little easier to implement from the standpoint of gross revenues generated.
Councilman Makowski, can you share with us, if you know, and if you don't, fine. I mean, where Measure D currently stands relative to the current general plan and local coastal plan update?
No, I can't.
Okay, thanks.
Can I give you a bit update? Because one of my homework assignments from a meeting or two ago where we discussed Measure D was, can Measure D be looked at in the general plan, local coastal plan update, and by what method can that be done? I spoke to Scott Graham, the community development director, and he told me that the GPAC, the General Plan Advisory Committee, and in addition to the consultants, Baker and Associates, they do intend to have a look at Measure D to try and address some of the ambiguity and give some sort of policy guidance. I asked him if it would be useful if our committee and the Harbor Advisory Board doing the lifting on that and trying to help make those determinations would be a useful thing, and he said absolutely. So I believe there is intention to address Measure D in the GP-LCP update and try and give some policy guidance to it to smooth out some of the ambiguity and make it so it's a little more sure for all of us without, as you say, completely undermining its intent. And like anything, if some sort of policy or language or clarification is put into the GCLCP and it survives to adoption by the City Council and eventual adoption by the Coastal Commission, then it essentially becomes the interpretive law of the day on Measure D until challenged in court, if that ever happens. And so I believe there's an opportunity here to get that inserted without going and changing the law and figure out what a reasonable interpretation of those ambiguities is and memorialize it in the GCLCP.
Okay, thank you. And what, for the public's benefit, what the Harbor Director, one of the things the Harbor Director was just referring to was, quote, Plan Morro Bay, end quote, which is assistance that Michael Baker International is providing to, it's a consulting firm providing to the city during the city's current project to update the general plan and the local coastal plan. And that document, the consultant's compilation, not just the consultant's opinion, but also its workshops and as the Harbor Director referred to, the work of the GPAC, the General Plan Advisory Committee, was last updated on December 2016. And under the commercial fishing industry and Measure D portion of that, the report offers some policy options, and they are clarify the meaning of, quote, clearly incidental uses on Measure D, reduce potential conflicts between commercial fishing and coastal recreational uses. I was unaware that there were conflicts, but apparently GPAC has identified, somebody's identified potential conflicts, and assist the commercial fishing industry to adapt to climate and economic change. I personally don't understand how the general plan and local coastal plan could assist with that. I think commercial fishermen, because they're businessmen and they live in that environment, probably are pretty aware of what they might need to do, but perhaps I'm wrong about that. But what I don't see in those policy options is addressing the potential ambiguity of primary.
I think that's where we have an opportunity to help that process out.
Okay. Okay. Well, it would be wonderful if the Harbor Advisory Board had that opportunity, given that, and I'm not speaking to you, speaking to the City Council, given that we actually haven't been provided that opportunity. We've taken the initiative to ask for it a number of times, but it hasn't come back to us, and the process keeps moving along. So we can wait for that. If somebody believes that it's going to be forthcoming, we'll wait for that. Otherwise, we can make a motion right now. I can make a motion right now, for instance, for the board's consideration relative to a recommendation to City Council regarding Measure D. But if there's going to be some future action, then that's not appropriate. What do you, sir?
Your points about Measure D are very well taken, and given the GPAC and LCP and the process it's going through, and even as Eric is talking, he's already speaking to Scott Graham about it, understanding the importance and the timing, as you're bringing up in terms of this body right here, Harbor, being it's pretty interested in that concept of Measure D. So I think one thing you could do to, if not ensure and speed up the process, but make sure that it is very much on the agenda of the GP, LCP group, is to make the, you know, make your motion and a recommendation to bring it to council. Then we could then, and we could either, if it was decided by council, to bring it to a council meeting. If nothing else, we could do that. And stroke or part number two, we could perhaps move it faster to and make it more transparent above board that it go to GP LCP.
As a possible alternative, Councilman, what about if the Harbor Advisory Board sent a letter to council, to which it serves, expressing its profound interest?
Totally.
Without making a motion, yep. In particular, without trying to direct how it would go.
No, totally. I think that would work just as well. If anything, it's going to put your interest as a body forward in saying this is very important, and express that in a stronger way, and a letter would do that, I think.
Okay, thank you.
I would copy it to the GPAC and the Community Development Director and Michael Baker. And
yes.
So do I have the permission of the board to draft such a letter, which I'll let's see, how can we get a review without disturbing the Brown Act?
Should I make a motion?
I don't. Sure.
Thank you. I'd like to make a motion that our chairman Ron draws up a letter to have the City Council address the Harbor Advisory Board prior to taking any action on Measure D. Is that?
I might suggest a slightly different wording, and that is that the Harbor Advisory Board request that the City Council involve the Harbor Advisory Board directly in the incorporation, consideration and incorporation of Measure D into the general plan and local coastal plan update.
That's exactly what I was going to say, Ron. Thank you.
Is there a second?
Second.
Okay. Any discussion?
Yeah, really we need to get around to primary, the word primary. So that's when we'll start talking about primary. And then I just had another question, Eric. Is the Dynegy property excluded from Measure D?
Yeah, Measure D, well, Ron, you've got it. I believe it says any, well.
It basically goes down the middle of Embarcadero.
I think it's just everything on the west side. It's our Tidelands lease sites is really what it looks at. I don't think
Correct.
It looks at anything across the street.
Correct.
But I was under the impression that the intake building was excluded, but I may be wrong.
Well, intake building was there before Measure D was enacted.
Yeah.
Like a restaurant, it was there before Measure D happened, so it can exist. Although Measure D doesn't address
it
at all.
So it would be, by definition, one of those quote-unquote non-conforming, which cannot be expanded or enlarged according to Measure D. Anything else? Call the question. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? None? Carries? Thank you. That brings us to agenda item C6, status of city-required revetment inspections on various city waterfront lease sites. Mr. Director?
Thank you. So most, but not all, of our city leases include a section in our lease requiring the lessees to periodically inspect and maintain their revetments and water improvements for condition and needed repairs and whatnot. And plan for those repairs and maintenance. Unfortunately, the language is not great. There's no certain provision on when those inspections must be conducted or by what means. It's just rather general language that says they need to keep up on maintaining your revetment and water improvements. Water improvements, for the most part, take care of themselves with leaseholders and slips and pilings. As they age, they get taken care of. The rock revetment, probably a little less so because it's just a big pile of rocks and everybody thinks it's fine, but it is a engineered structure that needs attention, as do seawalls. As we've seen at the boatyard complex where we've had a seawall partially failed, that is a fairly big issue. We're still trying to work through with that leaseholder to get that fixed. So coming out of that experience and the fact that we found, at least I couldn't find in my files going back a reasonable amount of time that we've ever holistically required our leaseholders to do those sorts of inspections. We went through late summer and requested of all of our leaseholders to do said inspections. Of the 30 master leases out there, I think there's three, maybe four that don't have that clause in their leases. It's on the city to do. It's the city's responsibility. So of those roughly 26 left, we sent out letters and been doing follow-up. We've received reports. I hadn't planned on going into the detail of any of those reports at this point. A couple of the reports are what I'd probably call not sufficient, and we're still working with those leaseholders to get the least minimum amount of inspection out of them and a better look at those facilities. All reports are in. We do have everything in. We're working through them, and as you can imagine, it's a fair amount of work. I can say fairly easily that there's no inspections that were major red flags, with the exception of the boatyard that's already failing that we now know about. While there are some issues out there underneath those lease sites, there were none that caused us to go run up the hill to the public works director to go get his red tag to go red tag things. There are some what I'd call significant maintenance issues. I wouldn't say there's any majorly catastrophic, oh my God, we got to fix it tomorrow type issues. And then there's a fair amount of garden variety, run-of-the-mill standard maintenance that everybody should be keeping up on. And it's kind of out of sight, out of mind when it's down below your deck and underneath your dock. You never look at it. And when you start looking at it, you find problems. So we're working through those. Not asking for any action from the Harbor Advisory Board. This is really just an informational item. If you'd like more detail on some of the inspections, I can bring some of that back. I'm at this point not prepared to really go into the inspection detail site by site. If anybody's interested, they can come review. Gene, you've did a lot of them anyhow. Associated Pacific did most of the others, and we had a peppered with a couple other independent engineering firms that did a few of the others. So that's the status on those. All in all, I'd say, given the age of that infrastructure, you know, the wall was put in, you know, back in World War II. It's had some issues. There's been some, I wouldn't call failures, but there's some areas that do need attention. On the rock seawall, the revetment. There are some old in the boatyard. Again, is probably the poster child. That was, I think, the old haul out for the landing craft there, that yard. So that wall was built way back then, and that's probably one of the main reasons it's failing. But there, all in all, as I said, there's some aging seawalls and some interestingly constructed structures down there. But again, nothing that's really exceptionally the boatyard that we can see that's failing. But there are issues that need to be addressed, so we're working through those, and hopefully we can get our leaseholders to take care of those and keep them going for another 70 years.
Okay, thanks. Questions, comments? Gene?
Yeah, the revetment along the Embarcadero was built by the Army Corps of Engineers, and it's a, if you took a section of it, it's a trapezoid section, maybe 40 to 60 feet at the base and maybe 40 feet or 20 to 40 feet on the top there, with a slope of say 2 to 1, and mostly 1-ton rock and bigger. Majority of it has sloughed off a little bit, but I don't see anything terribly bad. A lot of the pilings underneath there are still in fairly good shape. There's usually a head wall on the top there that starts supports the foundation, and there's some spalling, cracking at some of the rebar underneath the concrete there, but a majority of it looks in fairly good shape. So there are some that scare me, and there's an awful big rats down there too. So
yeah, I've seen some of those. Jeremiah? Comments? I'm just going down the line, as I said I would. So, Lynn? Yeah. Neil?
Just one comment. I think this is sufficient. I don't think we need to see individual reports on the lease sites unless there was something of great concern that was going to cost the city a lot of money.
Okay, I have three questions. So the staff report very candidly states that there's no certain provision for how often these inspections must be conducted. How will the Harbor Department address that, number one? Are there established qualifications for the inspecting entities, number two? Number three, are there minimum standards or criteria for the inspections?
First question, the requirement in the lease, as I said, the language is I wouldn't call it the greatest. It's in our standard lease format. We are embarking on a update of our lease management policy right now. It's one of our city council goals. With that, we're going to have our city attorney have a good look at our template lease, our template master lease, which was updated by probably Rick Algert and Rob Schultz maybe 15 years ago now, 10 years, maybe not quite that long, 10 years ago now. It's due for another update. That is one section that is already circled in red on mine that we're going to make it better because it is very generic. So that's the first question. You have to repeat the second and third questions for me. Sorry.
Sure.
Ask another question. So that only handles leases going forward. I just got a lease, for example, that's got 30 years, so that's another 30 years before an inspection if there's no language in there. But you said if you were really quoting the leases and the language that says as need be, well, can't the city's request that you just did be the as need be, and couldn't you guys calendarize that within your management plan?
The language, so you're correct. It's in the leases. Yeah, I could go to leaseholders and say, hey, you want to renegotiate this? Let's make this tougher on you. It's not something anybody's going to open up a lease for. It's going to be when leases are renegotiated. When folks want to do a major amendment of some sort, it might be part of the give and take. Some of the language we'll try and insert. So we'll make an effort to try and get it in our leases. But it's, you know, it's like the Harbor Walk. It's going to take a long time to eventually get the leases updated as they get renewed or amended.
So I guess my comment is more that knowing that those leases aren't going to change for the next, say, if somebody's got a 50-year lease, but if the language says as need be now, already in the existing lease, that's 50 years, could the city, I mean, you were able to just now go through and ask everybody to get this inspection done, couldn't you just say, like, come up with a number and maybe get the feedback from the board or maybe an engineer or somebody and say, this should be done every 10 years or this should be done every 15, and every 10 or 15 years you send out a letter that says,
yes,
this is the need be done.
Yeah, I see where, yeah. Thank you for clarifying. Without, yes, yeah. The language says most of them. There's a couple anomalies like all of our leases. They seem to be little permutations of different language. The leases say at quote-unquote reasonable intervals. There's plenty of engineering standard out there. There's a ton of Navy documentation out there on inspections of wharves and piers and quays and all the other stuff and recommended intervals. And if you go talk to an engineer familiar with or an architect with all the other stamps you've got on top of it, and talk to them when those sorts of structures should be inspected, there's standards out there. And moving forward, absent specific language in the lease that says that, we would purport to follow those sorts of industry standards into the future. Because that would, I think, would hold up in a court of law that it's reasonable interval. Well, these reasonable intervals is what the industry standard is.
Ron? Can I make a comment?
Please.
Could we also include some kind of deal, like if there's a tsunami or tidal wave, that you want somebody to come back in and look at structures later on? After that,
something like that. It's a good idea when something like that happens to go for everybody. Everybody should, you know, their insurance is going to drive that to a degree. If things get thrown around, you're going to want to take a good assessment. Question two
was qualifications for inspecting entities.
The leases don't call out any sorts of qualifications. They just say a maintenance and repair survey. We interpret a structure, whether it's the slip, dock, wharf, revetment, seawall, for someone to make a reasonable survey out of that. There either need to be an engineer, an architect with the right stamps. So that's the interpretation we've taken, that we want you to have an engineer look at it, not just your brother-in-law that does construction.
So you mean AIA or PE? Is that what you're saying?
You're going to have to educate me on your acronyms.
Go ahead, Gene.
I believe in your letter to the leaseholders that you mentioned a professional engineer or somebody who's qualified in that expertise in that field.
Experience in the marine environment, I think.
But is that professional engineer capital P, capital E, or small P, E, which is a whole different thing?
I don't remember reading it. I think you just said professional experience in that engineering, architect, something like that.
Yeah. Better be careful, because I could be doing them.
Third question?
I'm bothered by the second one, but third one is what's your thoughts about minimum standards or criteria for the inspections?
I think it harkens back to my answer to the first question. It's industry standard. Been looking at what's out there already published. I know I've got some pretty heavy documents laying around that tells you, you know, I've got my engineer, city engineer, Bruce Elster, our contract engineers, got our peers on an inspection program, and it's a very rigorous schedule. I mean, to go back to the second question, I don't mean to be flip about it. Our language is weak. It's not great language. I wish it was better.
We all heard loud and clear that you intend to address that moving forward when the template is updated, but that brings us to Neil's point about, you know, well, what happens for the 30 that, you know, are not going to be updated anytime soon. And is it, and this might be rhetorical, but is it not possible for the city to establish policy that illuminates the lease language without abrogating the lease language?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. That could be part of, not only could, but should. It's a good place to insert that into the lease management policy. The lease management policy probably doesn't really address, it's just the administrative document on how we manage and control and renew and negotiate leases. It could easily have reference in there to policy on this and other things that we would like to get some clarification on. And then it becomes a city council adopted document, so then it becomes a little more power of law behind it.
Yeah, and I, speaking for the board, I'd really appreciate it if you would think about that. I know you do all the time, but if you would think about it in a way that would, where you could bring your thinking, your codified thinking, back to the board and perhaps suggest some proactivity, not for us, because that's not our province. We don't set policy. But I think we'd all really applaud the city moving in a direction to give itself a little more control over what are some very important and very expensive infrastructure items that directly affect public safety. Okay, anything else on this item? Nope, thanks. Okay, so that brings us to C7. C7 is review and amendment of existing future agenda items. And Eric was kind enough to, he and I went through the list of future agenda items, the declared future agenda items, and he was kind enough to draft this discussion item. And what I would suggest is that, I'm presuming the board's already taken a look at this, I'd entertain a motion to accept recommendations for items 1 through 8 on this agenda item.
So moved.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay. Any discussion?
Is this in the order that they will be coming up to us? Is this the...
No.
Okay.
I think this was just the order that they were on the list, the okay. running list.
What would that discussion need to happen now about an order, or do we just need to address?
Not right okay. now. Okay. There's a motion on the table, but that would be an excellent thing to talk about. Anything else? Any other discussion directly on the motion? Okay. Call the question. All in favor? Aye. Opposed? None. Carries. So the Harbor Office will help us out by in the next minutes. You'll see an adjusted list of future agenda items. And that brings us to item D, declaration of future agenda items. So, Neil, your point's well taken. Why don't you talk about that a little bit before we get into whether... Well, actually, let me do this first. Does any board member have a future agenda item that they would like to have declared that is not currently on the list? Gene? Jeremiah? Lynn?
No.
Neil?
No.
Okay, I do. So, for the board's consideration, I'd like to suggest that we add an updated and current report from the Morro Bay Community Quota Fund that advises on their current activities. Have the new, not so new, but their executive director come and give us an update on what's going on. Any objections to that?
No, and if they can't make it, send a liaison or
submit a report. No, the executive director's local.
Okay.
So, yeah. Okay, good. Okay, we'll take care of that one. Eric, should I give you or Lori some notes after this, or are you keeping up with us?
I'm keeping up, but I'll take notes.
Okay, thanks.
Both.
All right.
And Gina, probably going to want some of your stuff, too.
Okay, so that one was approved. At one point in time, there was some discussion about the potential, about the possibility of declaring an agenda item to discuss expanded fish cold storage capabilities in Morro Bay. And there was a little bit of research done about that, about the users and the cubic volume and the nature of the facility. And where that was left was that it required input from the commercial fishing industry, from whom we've never heard back. So,
when was this done?
About a year and a half ago. So speaking to the commercial fishing industry, if it's interested in having the Harbor Advisory Board consider the topic of expanded cold store facilities here in Morro Bay, then I would invite the industry in some organized manner to contact the Harbor Advisory Board through, I would suggest, the commercial fishing seat, and which is currently occupied by three fishermen, and get back to us. So the another one is
Ron, can I speak to your last one?
Sure.
It might also be helpful to have, I'm not sure if Giovanni's has cold storage. I know that Central Coast Seafood does down at the dock by the dockside. They have cold storage. But it might be helpful if the commercial fishermen are interested in this discussion to then also maybe incorporate what cold storage exists so we could hear about what the current capacity is and what the deficit is if that exists.
Right. You know, actually, on this issue, we had done some research in the past, and we did that with Lisa Wise Consulting. And what had happened with the issue, I believe, was it came in number two on the wish list, if you will. So there was Boatyard was the first on the top of the list, and the cold storage was the second. And I believe it was pretty much the feeling of most people that it would be too much to tackle two projects of that size simultaneously. So with the Boatyard at the top of the list, that was the first one apparently that we're still looking into. Now, what I'll do is go back, and if we want to address this again, which I think it's a fine idea, and I'll see if I can dig up some of Lisa Wise's research on the issue.
Sure, and bearing in mind that under the current budget forecasting situation, it's unlikely that the city would be in a position to participate financially.
Okay, well, in that regard, I would just like to remind everybody here that the city had a very tiny investment, say, in the ice facility that's currently in use. It was $907,000. Now, I'm not saying that $907,000, unfortunately, doesn't buy much of a cold storage facility, but that being said, who knows what's possible in the future. And there is opportunity, I believe, and people that we've been talking to who could perhaps find some investment moving in that direction.
Okay. And I don't know that we need to declare it, but there's been ongoing discussion with the board about the nature and extent of the Morro Bay Harbor mooring field. And during recent discussions with the harbor director, he agreed to work to generate an agenda item for an upcoming HAB meeting regarding that. And it's speaking just for myself. It's mapping that I'm, and I know Gene has expressed his thoughts on this in the past. But it's mapping that I'm interested in, and it's interesting to note that the city has a GIS mapping program already. So we'll leave that in the harbor director's hands. And that's all I had. It's actually just that one item. So anything else? Anything else on future agenda items? Yeah?
Not to add. Will there be room for discussion?
Right now. So you wanted to talk about ordering them.
Yeah, just a priority. Part of my desire is based on the report that I gave and when I was looking at the numbers of negative 16,000 and zero for the next 2 years, thinking about this last one here, deliberate on paid parking on the Embarcadero, moving items that might directly impact the budget and financial status of Morro Bay, might be prudent to move those to the top.
What I would appreciate as it relates to ordering, because we need to come up with our work plan moving forward. Right now, to my knowledge, the board doesn't have a formalized work plan for the balance of 2017, and I would appreciate that, is if each board member would take a look at the standing declared agenda items and prioritize them. Send that to me, each of you individually. You can copy the rest, but you can't comment on it, or we're in violation of the Brown Act. But if you would send those to me, I will collate them. And don't just order them for me, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but also give me a very brief explanation of why you think it's that particular priority, please, so that I can give it some weighting. Everybody okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay, that'd be great. All right, anything else on agenda items? No?
No.
Okay, that pretty well wraps her up. So I have a motion to adjourn. Oh, Gene?
I want to thank Matt for being here. Thanks.
Yeah, long day, long night. Thank you. Okay, do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Second from Lynn. Okay, moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? None. Carries. Thank you. Thank you very much.